Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com.
Today on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, we're 25 days into a government shutdown, and the TSA is reporting 137% more sick calls compared to a year ago. But they seem to be the only ones calling in sick. Even those of us who are, we're going to work or working from home. We'll open the lines and ask if you're part of this sick day sickness. Then Sports Authority Trenny Kuznarek is here to talk about the Pats comeback, how retired swimmer Michael Phelps is still making a splash, and how 10 wasn't nearly enough for one gymnast's floor routine.
At noon, Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell joins us to talk about her push to diversify the police and fire departments. Then food writer Corby Kummer is here to talk about the farmers who've been hit hard by trade wars, and now they aren't getting their insurance checks because of the government shutdown. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Tuesday. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the Boston Public Library. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. I should just say, even though we're going to discuss this with John King from CNN in a couple of hours, the president's nominee, William Barr, to be the Attorney General of the United States, is testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he is saying on the critical issues, at least several of the critical issues, that he believes it's, quote, vitally important that Mueller complete his investigation. He said he does not see it as a witch hunt. Remember, he had sent without being asked, some pretty critical comments recently. And secondly, that he believed that the public should, of course, be getting whatever information that Mueller releases, subject to the law, whatever that means. But we'll discuss that in depth with John King a little after 1 o'clock. But first, the late great Senator Paul Tsongas said, that's how the book ended. Nobody on their deathbed has ever said, I wish I had spent more time at the office. Really? We sure act like that would be a deathbed regret. According to a 2016 study, each week, listen to this, about 1.5 million Americans without paid sick leave go to work despite feeling ill. And for those of us who do have sick leave, many of us are reluctant to use them. So as we're entering peak flu season, we thought we'd open lines and ask if the sick day has vanished from your vocabulary, 877-301-8970. If you're on the job right now and you're sick, please give us a call. If you're someone who can't afford literally to call in sick, we want to hear from you. And if you're that rare person who does call in sick, like Marjorie, where do you find the courage to do so? 877-301-8970. The theory in the pieces that you and I read,
yes,
there are a couple of reasons people are not using, several reasons. One, a lot of people don't have paid sick leave. 45% of Americans have no paid sick leave.
Let's just stop there for a second. We are the biggest suckers in the world.
We are.
Other countries with great economies seem to manage to give people sick time. Even small businesses give people sick time. But we in America just can't seem to do it.
So that's one. 45% have no paid sick leave. Remember, the earned sick time law went into effect here in Massachusetts in 2015. So that's one. Two, those who do have it are often reluctant to use it because they're afraid they're going to be seen as not loyal or not hardworking, so they go in sick and infect all of their coworkers. Or because a lot of people work from home these days. What do Ruth Bader Ginsburg and our lead producer, Chelsea Murs, have in common?
They both work from home.
When they're sick.
I know. Chelsea will be out sick, and I'll get 17 phone calls or text messages before 7 o'clock in the morning. So
and Ruth Bader Ginsburg is allegedly participating in the decision-making, even though for the first time in 25 years, the justice of the Supreme Court missed an oral argument. So we want to know about your approach to sick leave in 2018. Do you have it? Do you use it? And once again, I wouldn't even Google Western Europe. We are in a different world from people part of the world.
You know, remember the president wanted to have immigrants come from Scandinavian countries?
Norway.
Yeah. Well, another one of those countries up there is the Netherlands. Listen to this. They have the most generous...
It's not up there, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's up there. It's
north.
It's
not a northern
The Netherlands is not?
No.
It's not?
No, I don't think so. But whatever.
It's cold. They have up to 104 weeks or 2 years of sick time. And they get 70% of their salary. And aren't they one of the happiest nations on earth?
I think they're really
happy. Yeah, they're very happy
up there.
I think
the Danes are the happiest.
I think those northern countries are very happy up there.
They are?
It's not very sunny out. You know, one of the beauties of being a talk show host is that sometimes, this has happened to me a few times in my story career, such as it is, when I've had a cold and I've lost my voice.
Yeah.
You know what that means?
Yeah, you stay home
and
you go shopping.
I can't come to work. I don't feel that bad. I just got a cold, but I can't talk. So it's a wonderful thing, Jim.
No, you say you can't talk, I should say.
I couldn't talk.
How many sick days? I mean, I hate to toot my own horn, but I think I will for
a few
minutes.
You come to work sick.
I come to work sick.
You come to work sick and make everybody else sick.
Because I believe, unlike you, obviously, I have an obligation to our listeners. And you decide, well, I got to shop, so maybe I can lose my voice today.
I did get two
and
shopping
stay home
days
sick.
Right before Christmas. No, you believe you're indispensable. That's what your deal is.
Well, maybe I am.
It's always one of those things on a snow day, you know, who's an absolutely necessary worker? What's the word for it? They say that
essential employees. Yeah. Like the federal government
right
now.
You don't feel good that you're an unessential employee.
Non-essential,
but
it
is amazing what some of these people do in these stories.
Like what?
This guy talked about how...
Is this a New York Times follow-up?
This is a New York Times story about people never taking a sick day.
Yeah.
One woman talks about how she had to edit a book because the book was due while passing a kidney stone, which is supposed to be absolutely agonizing. But she did it because she had to get the book done on time. Another guy talks about how he never took any time off until his poor wife was in a hospice, and then he decided that he would stay home and take care of her in the last days before she died. And somebody else worked through their radiation treatment.
Can I tell you, it is a pogo-ass situation. I've seen the enemy, and it is us. It is the system where, again, almost half of American workers have no paid sick leave. But for those of us who do, this notion that we shouldn't take it when we are sick is almost obscene. And it's part of this. I mean, it's just we have a troubling mentality, I would say, about work and our personal lives and our health and all that sort of stuff. So in any case, particularly in flu season, we thought it was appropriate to talk about your approach to sick leave. 877-301-8970. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with John in Sandy Hook. Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Hi. I retired from teaching a while ago.
Yeah.
But I went in sick, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
We had in the school district where I worked, accumulated sick leave. I accumulated 150 days, and those I left behind when I left teaching. I would say to my kids when I had laryngitis, the sixth graders were wonderful, I would say, look, I've got laryngitis today, so I'm going to have to whisper, and you really have to listen. And they did.
Well, let me tell you something. I don't want to say you made a wrong career choice because I love teachers, but you should have worked at Massport because up until they did some reforms here, John, and thank you for your call, I think you could leave Massport with, 40 years of accumulated sick leave or whatever it was?
It was always amazing. Somebody would leave, and they'd have accumulated hundreds and hundreds of days of sick leave.
And get paid for them.
Which the taxpayers of Massachusetts were paying for.
On the hook for.
Yeah, those are nice deals if you can get them. Okay, let's go to Jennifer in North Attleboro. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you today?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Good. You sound great, Jennifer.
Hi.
I wanted to offer you guys some positivity on this.
Oh, please. We need it. Go ahead.
When it comes to sick time, my company and actually my recent companies have all offered the opportunity to work from home and insisted you work from home when you're sick so that you can have that perfect balance of, you know, sleep in, get some rest, and then check your email so it's not piling up when you can, rest when you can. I think for the first time in a long time, we're in a really great position where we can have that work balance, where you have the time to rest and the time to get something done so you're not coming into a mountain of work.
You know, Jennifer, my attitude about employers like that is severalfold. Is one, they're doing it because they're decent people, but also because they understand productivity. And if you go to work sick, you're going to get somebody else sick. But the other thing, it seems to me, and maybe the lift in your voice suggests that I'm right about this, doesn't an employee like you feel far better about their workplace and their boss when you're treated that way? I mean, doesn't that change your attitude to your relationship with your employer?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it does too. It's a huge thing. Jennifer, you sound great, and you lifted our spirits, and stay well. 877-301-8970.
You know, we're lucky too, because if we're sick, the work doesn't accumulate. But if you're someone whose work accumulates,
that's a very good point.
That's a real problem.
That is a really good point,
Thank
by the way.
Jim.
No, it's a really good point, because it's not just
this notion actually that somebody's.
It wasn't brilliant. I mean, it was obvious,
but I
was going to make it in 2 minutes. But you obviously decided you would make it now. But it is really true. One of the beauties, you're really right, by the way.
Yeah.
That is nothing
you're
piles
sick,
up.
Somebody else comes in and does a show, Jim.
Yeah, but it's interesting. When you were home, allegedly sick with no voice, you weren't, like, doing anything like Ruth Bader Ginsburg in Chelsea, were you? Contributing to the show? Pick up your phone?
I was at the mall.
You were?
I was at the mall doing my Christmas shopping. It was a beautiful time to lose your voice, too.
But in all, does it not say something really perverse about our society? I was trying to articulate
this
before.
About the United States of America?
That we feel...
We are total suckers.
That was
we are absolutely total suckers. No maternity leave. I mean, I can't believe I was just talking to somebody the other day that works for a rather progressive company who told me that her maternity leave was like 6 to 8 weeks of disability. And I thought, that's what it was 30 years ago when I had my first kid. How have we not... Now, I know there are some companies that give you 6 months, and some people give you a lot of that paid or all of it paid, so there has been some move in the right direction, but it's just insane.
Some individual states have addressed this like we have here, but, you know, for those who think, well, didn't the Family and Medical Leave Act under Bill Clinton resolve a lot of these things? The answer is no.
Because you don't get any money.
It's unpaid, right?
I mean, listen to what we're hearing now in this federal shutdown, that so many workers are working paycheck to paycheck. What was that incredible statistic? Like 40% of Americans are working paycheck to paycheck, which is another statement of how...
No, it's actually 80% are working paycheck to paycheck.
It's 80%?
80%. And 40% said that if they needed to come up with $400 cash for an unexpected situation, an emergency, they could not do it.
And that's because, of course, we can't possibly raise the minimum wage, or we can't possibly keep wages tied to the cost of living. We can't possibly do that in the United States of America.
But we're doing it in some
places. Because the businesses tell us they just can't afford it.
Well, like Durgan Park did.
But you know, when you look at some of the salaries of the people that run the places, you're kind of a little bit suspicious if that's really true.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Connor in Boston. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're live at the Boston Public Library. Hey there.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Second time calling.
Woo.
I think I called last year. So I have a kind of short, I'll make this short,
go ahead,
interesting story. So I work at Marshall's in Boston, and essentially I ended up becoming sick, and no one really, how do I say this? I was sick for a long period of time. I ended up contracting bronchitis. So I was actually, apparently, according to them, a pain in the ass for keep taking days off for being sick. Eventually, I got better, and once I got back in the job, they were like, oh, you were sick. I'm like, yeah.
So what was their point? They thought, Connor, the point was that they thought you were faking it?
Well, initially when I was contracting it, they said, can you just keep coming in? Like, we don't.
No, it's good. You can infect all the customers and all of your coworkers.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you have the opposite. Thank you for the call. You have the opposite employer from the prior caller. You know, an employer who is not only suspicious but is urging you to work whether you're sick or not, as opposed to an enlightened employer. Bless you, Marjorie. An enlightened employer who understands if you're sick, it's better for your coworkers, it's better for the company, and most importantly, best for you if you attend to your illness. 877-301-8970.
Then why do you come in when you're sick?
Well, you want a serious thing for a second?
Sure.
You won't mock me?
Nope.
I do not consider myself an essential employee, but when you do what we do, it's a little bit different, and you sort of feel there's an expectation. People tune in, and they expect Marjorie Egan, that would be you, and me, I am Jim Browdy, to do something. So I sort of feel, as long as you're not so sick that you're going to infect the whole team, that you sort of have an obligation to do the best you can. You obviously don't feel that way, so that's... That is, by the way, we worked together 19 years. You ever taken a sick day other than when you lost your voice?
Yeah, I had the flu once about 10 years ago.
You did? I don't even remember that.
No, I did.
So
I
why
did.
Do you come in all the time? Either days you come in when you don't feel so hot.
Because luckily, I shouldn't say this because the moment I say it, I'll get sick, but I haven't been that sick.
Really?
Not yet. Knock on wood.
Okay.
I'll
well, knock on wood.
Run over by a Mack truck on my way home.
Well,
I hope, really.
Would Sue
in Falmouth.
Horrible?
Hi, Sue.
By the way, if you do get hit by a Mack truck, which all of us hope doesn't happen, don't come in. Sue, from Falmouth. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up?
Hi. I just want to compliment you on your show, first of all. I really enjoy it.
Thanks.
I am a retired public school teacher.
Yeah.
And there is a huge culture in public schools of not calling in because of the inconvenience to everybody. You've got to call. If you wake up sick on the day that you are supposed to go in, you need to call somebody by, say, 5:30 or 6 in the morning because they've got to get a substitute.
Sure.
And very often you're waking somebody up who is not happy with being woken up. I've been the recipient of a lot of complaints calling in.
Wait a second. You've been the recipient of complaints because you had the audacity to give them notice that you weren't feeling well?
Exactly. And they need to get a substitute for you.
I understand.
They've got a limited window of time.
Well,
I've received complaints.
You have a horrible connection, so we got to let you go. Thank you much for the. This gets back to the treatment thing. I mean, you are rewarded in terms of the quality of the work of your employees and the productivity of your employees if you treat them respectfully when they say they're sick. If there appears to be a trend of faux illness, that's one thing. But if somebody who's a good worker says they're sick, treat them respectfully, help them if mm-hmm. they can, and it will come back to you.
Remember we talked about the people banging in?
Yeah.
The state workers.
Didn't we have a big debate about whether you banged in? What was the verb? Didn't we have a discussion?
I think it was bang.
It was banging in?
I think
in?
So. Yeah, that was the expression for a lot of people. The numbers of people who bang in seems to increase mysteriously on Fridays and on Mondays. And a long weekend, if it's a long weekend like Martin Luther King Day, it's incredible how somehow everybody gets sick on the Thursday before the long weekend.
You know, one of the great things, I feel bad because I'm often saying unkind things about your former employer, the Boston Herald, which did cut off your health benefits on a Friday, even though you have three children with absolutely no notice after you worked there for 30 years. But putting that aside I shouldn't mention that, but putting that aside for a second, one of the things they did so great in the old days is they did expose these scams, like we talked about a minute ago, where these people who are making hundreds of grand on the public payroll are leaving with years worth of sick leave.
Yeah.
It's unconscionable.
Well, you know, we all should have been state workers. It's true. You're not going to get rich being a state worker. There's no question about it. But generally speaking,
Get rich as a state worker.
Well, some
worker.
Do. Well, you talked about one of your buddies there. You get a $500,000 a year pension?
The guy your former coworker, Howie Carr, was writing about Marty Meehan, who's head of UMass, who was also a member of Congress for a while, who was going to do quite well when he retires.
$500,000 pension?
Well, Bill Bulger is doing pretty well as a former
president. Well, his is a mere $200,000.
It's only a couple $100,000.
But he retired like 20 years ago. He looks fantastic, too.
You know,
Bill Bulger's got to be close to 80.
This has nothing to do with our topic, but since you brought it up, and then we'll take a break and we'll continue with the phone calls. We had a discussion years ago, not with this governor, who's been there 4 years and a few months. By the way, Charlie Baker will be with us on Thursday of this week.
Great.
He hasn't been on in a few months. He'll be on Thursday at noon if you have questions for him. But with the prior governor, we discussed, Deval Patrick, pretty regularly about whether or not there should be a cap, $100,000 something, on state pensions. Because, you know, whenever they do that list, there's a lot of UMass medical. Hundreds of thousands. I mean, I'm with you. It's a bit of an issue.
Well, they had a great piece, and people that work for the MBTA, again, they don't make a lot of money either. But there was a great piece in the Globe the other day, an op-ed, talking about the fact that there are more people collecting pensions from the MBTA than there are working at the MBTA. And that you know, you can retire, I think it's 60% or 70% of your salary after some 20, 25 years, something. So that means you're retiring pretty young.
Well, there were some reforms there after you complained. Actually, I think you may have been.
It was Deval Patrick.
Because you complained to him every single
month
he was on.
But he only made that for workers that were hired after 2009, which is sort of a fairness thing in a way, because if you were hired in the 80s, you were expecting this kind of thing. But that's part of the problem is that taxpayers are going to be on the hole because they're going to have to pay for the pensions because it's going to run out of money.
Yeah, but you had I don't want to get into this in depth. You had a very small-minded position. You had a problem with the fact that MBTA workers got lifetime pensions and retired at 27.
No, it wasn't actually 20. I think they had to work until
it was 20 years. It was
20
like
years.
Until they were 40.
Yeah, if you started at 18, you could retire at 38.
We got to take a break, Marjorie. That's how this works.
Okay. We're talking about basically what fools we are in the United States of America, putting up with the fact that so many of us can't get a paid sick day or even take a day off from work. How Americans fall down on the job, basically, when it comes to calling in sick. We're going to keep talking about it at 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bradley. She's Marjorie. And we're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the death of the sick day. With more people working from home when they're sick or going into the workplace when they are, why is it that it takes a government shutdown and employees not making any money to actually call in sick? I don't know if you know the TSA call in sick rate is roughly twice what it is normally. And by the way, it should be.
To the airport early.
3 hours in Atlanta. 877-301-8970. Do you work somewhere that encourages you to call in sick when you are, like that woman who called earlier in the hour? Are you a contractor or a temp worker who actually can't afford to call in sick? Or even if you're a full-time employee, if you're one of the 45% of American workers who doesn't even have paid sick leave. And if you're on your sick bed right now, how hard was it for you to call the boss to say, I am not coming in, I am sick? 877-301-8970.
And big picture, why are we such sheep when it comes to, and it isn't just post-recession when people were so afraid of losing their jobs after 2007, 2008. Mm-hmm. This preceded this. We've kind of been sheep-like for a long time. How come other countries that have really thriving economies, like the Germans or a lot of the European, well, the Europeans.
I would blame it on the employers, not on the employees. I would say that when your employer makes it clear that you will not, it will not be appreciated if you call in sick, then you accept the message and you don't call in sick, or you very hesitantly call in sick. I don't have, I'm not an workplace historian, but we should ask Nancy Kane this. My bet is it started on the employer side of thing, and then it became part of the American culture, which
is horrible.
Or maybe
also because so few private sector workers are unionized anymore. They don't have those union
protections. I'm not sure this is a new phenomenon, but I'm not. By the way, 7% of people, workers in the private sector are in unions, which is
pathetic. Just said that, Jim.
You said seven?
I said seven.
So few. Oh, you said seven?
I said seven.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
That. Sorry. Let's go to Will in Reading. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you. First time caller. Very nice. Appreciate it.
I'm on my second day of being homesick.
Oh.
My company is very supportive of people staying home so they don't get the other employees sick. This tradition goes way back, at least 30 years in our company.
What's the company? Let's be nice to them. What's the company?
Yeah, it's C.B. Fisk. We're a pipe organ company up in Gloucester.
Pipe organ?
We have instruments at Harvard Memorial Church and Old West. And
oh, that
King
is
Chapel,
great.
Just in this area. But and we work internationally, but in a sense, we may be competing with foreign companies, too. But the company's had this philosophy for at least 30 years to take care of the employees, including health care benefits.
Wow.
Long before other small organ companies provided that. So,
let me ask you the same thing I asked the woman who called earlier who felt similarly positive about how their employer treated her when she was sick. You're actually sick as we're talking to you. Doesn't it creates a bond with your employer that doesn't exist in a lot of places, doesn't it, or does it?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, at the end of the year, you know, we don't get our sick days if we haven't used them as compensation. But I'm perfectly happy to save the company some money by not using my sick days. And there's several people that go the whole year without using them. I do, and myself included. It's just... If the company does something for you, you're willing to do something for them.
I agree. This is a great first call, Will. Feel better soon, and thank you for sharing your sick day with us. We really appreciate it.
You know what? One of these stories talks about how the smartphones have changed a lot, not just your computer and stuff, that you can do a lot of stuff just lying in bed in your smartphone now or lying in bed with your iPad or your
computer. You can be in, like, Florida and live. I mean, that's one of the beauties. If you know they can't track you, you can be doing it. I don't want to name names. Do you remember when that this is long before the advent of the smartphone. Do you remember when that guy on news radio would do the morning news.
Oh,
and he would
from
talk,
Florida?
He would talk about how the weather, oh, this really stormy here today, and he was calling in,
was
doing the broadcast
Palm
from
Beach.
An ISDN line, and pretty well-known and respected news guy for many, many, many years here in Boston.
Let's go to Tim in Worcester. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Tim.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Thanks.
Great, great show.
Thanks.
I get no sick days.
That's awful. What kind of company?
That's retail. I can't say, but Jim knows me as a shoe guy with the Yak Track.
Exactly. Wait a second. Tim, before you go ahead, when you say you get no sick days, you get no paid sick days or you get no sick days at all?
Both.
So wait a second. So when you're sick, what are you? Are you supposed to stay home and just go unpaid like a federal worker? Is that the way it works?
You get nothing.
Nothing. Got it. Nothing
so,
says
so,
it. Got it.
So how do your fellow?
That's it.
So Tim, how do your fellow workers feel about this? Do they feel kind of screwed?
Pretty much. Yeah.
And
yeah. I did a full ankle rotation while trail running.
Mm-hmm.
I was in work the next day on crutches.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that's why I don't do any full rotation trail running or whatever the thing was. Hey, Tim, thank you for sharing your story. I mean, you can hear in his voice. This is perfect, by the way. The most important part of this discussion was not what I thought it was going to be about how people use sick leave or not. The most important part of this discussion for the last 20 minutes, how do you feel about your employer when he or she is one who encourages you to take care of yourself when you're sick, as opposed to employers like Tim's, who not only don't encourage you to take care of yourself, don't pay you and expect you to come in on crutches.
Well, I think that's one of the things that you learn is that when your employer screws you, you don't feel bad screwing them back.
Beautifully put.
I remember once working for a company where you actually had to, like you're working in a factory, you had to punch in and punch out. You just say where you were going and when you were going. And all anybody wanted to do was try to fool them and see if they could get away. I mean, the hostility toward the employer was huge.
You were speaking of that employer. What's the name of that? Who was that?
I'm not telling you.
Do you remember the employer that canceled your health benefits when you had three children after working there 30 years on a Friday afternoon?
Yes, I do.
And by the way, to make that even worse, not that we should talk
about
it.
You're obsessed with this
story, Margie doesn't like me talking about it.
Okay.
But not only did they cut off her health benefits after working there 30 years on a Friday afternoon, they called her to tell her when they knew she was on the air so she couldn't respond, and they left a voicemail. But I'm not telling that story
anymore.
But
I didn't let them get away with it, Jim.
No, you didn't.
No, I did not. Let's
Mike
go
in the car.
Mike in the car. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi. Hi, guys. First time, long time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Enjoy the show. Listen every day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, so my employer, I'm employed in Rhode Island, and they passed a bill where it's mandatory your employer has to pay 3 days of sick time.
A year?
In Rhode Island. It's the law.
Okay.
But my employer seems to think if you call up more than 3 days, you get penalized. And if you call up eight times a year, you could be fired.
That is
So what happens if somebody
is really sick?
Yeah, gets in a car accident or something, and they're in the hospital. Or what happens? They get fired?
Well, thankfully, I would assume so. But thankfully, that hasn't happened to anybody yet. But as an example, I called out 4 times last year, and 5 times, actually. I got a written warning for my 5th one. And if I called out another time after that, I would have been suspended 1 day. If I called out 7 times, 3 day suspension. And if you call 8 times, you're fired.
Mike, are you a decent worker?
Yeah, I'd like to think so.
And does your employer think you're a decent worker?
I mean, I'm definitely valuable to the company.
What sort of company?
Delivery company.
Wow, that's really awesome. Yep. And I guess, you know. So does anybody complain about this or say, you know, I got the flu? What the hell am I supposed to do?
Oh yeah, all the time. But we actually unionized last year too. But you know, there's only so much people can do. Contract.
Well, I mean, but one thing they can do with the contract is ensure that if you're actually sick up to more than 3 days, that you are allowed to do it. Mike, we wish you luck, and we're really glad you finally called in. We hope you do it again soon. Is there a takeaway from this discussion? Yes, there is.
The takeaway is that we are really,
suckers.
I find this ironic about the United States of America, the rugged individuals.
That's what it is, by the way.
We all have to, we all fend for ourselves and stuff, and we get rolled over all the time by our employers, and no one seems to get worked up about it. And that's why I always say I love in France, they try to cut your pension by, 1.0%, and
they're out in the
thousands
streets.
Of people take to the street complaining, and we just seem to take it. It's really odd.
It is.
Okay.
It's the end
we are
of
moving
discussion,
on.
Marjorie.
Up next, we're going to talk to Trenti Kuznarek.
Yes, we are.
Are the Patriots headed toward another Super Bowl? They sure had a great game this weekend. Listen to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio live from our studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan live at our Boston Public Library. Who knew that Tom Brady and the Pats would turn out to be the NFL's underdogs this year? Does that make it harder to hate them and more fun to cheer on as they head into their eighth straight AFC championship game this Sunday? I know that because Marjorie told me, of course.
That's right.
Joining us for her take on this and other sports headlines is the ill Trenti Kuznarek, who is going to work regardless. She's an anchor, reporter for NBC Sports Boston, and a BPR contributor. Hey, Trenti Kuznarek.
Hi. Well, if I called out every time I had like a cough or something, I would never go to work.
Exactly.
Beautifully put.
You know, it cracks me up. I'm not the biggest sports fan in the world. I mean,
here
I do like to watch. I'm a fair weather fan. I guess I'll watch the Super Bowl, et cetera. But it always cracks me up in the sports world. In Boston, here with the Patriots, it's always, is Tom Brady too old? Oops, he didn't play that well. He's too old. He's had it. Now he had a great game. Now he's back. It's like, he's too old. He's not too old. He's too old. He's not too old. So now I guess he's not too old because he did well on Sunday.
I mean,
or was it Saturday?
It should be noted that the pieces around him played really well. They finally got a Julian Edelman. And that's not to take anything away from what Tom Brady did.
Yep.
Tom Brady was masterful.
It was unbelievable.
But he didn't throw a touchdown. He didn't throw a touchdown pass.
Well, he didn't need to throw a
touchdown.
He didn't
need to.
And
because
those 40, they were all running
plays. Wait a second. He had one. Didn't he have one touchdown pass? I thought he had one. Whatever he did.
Maybe he did. Maybe I'm misremembering, okay. Which is quite possible because they did score 40-some points.
Okay.
But they have a running back in James White and another running back in Sony Michel who sort of helped take the pressure off of Tom Brady. And then you had a Julian Edelman who played really well. So I think what he's doing is what they're – and Marjorie, I know that you watch a lot of New Orleans Saints games.
I do, but they went after the quarterback.
Drew Brees, also an older quarterback. I believe he's 39. And what they did a few years ago is they signed a running back by the name of Alvin Kamara, and it's really changed the way that Drew Brees manages the game. And it just takes a little bit of pressure off him. And I think that's what they're finally getting with White and Sony Michel, who's healthy, which is why a lot of people said when they drafted Sony Michel in the first round, why would you draft a running back? This is so dumb. And it's turned out to be a brilliant move because it takes a little bit of pressure off of Tom.
But can I say something? I don't know much more about the sport, even though I watch more of it than Marjorie does. When you're watching this game and you focus on the fact that this guy is old enough to be the father of virtually everybody else who's on the field, it is really, it's incredible. I mean, it is
incredible. Oh, it's
incredible.
And as a fellow 41-year-old, I think it's remarkable. And I'm like, keep all the old people, him, Zdeno Chara, Jaromir Jagr, the Serena Williams and Roger Federers of the world, keep getting into your late 30s, early 40s and absolutely dominating sports because that makes all of us middle-aged people feel better.
Exactly. They had a great front page of the sports section of the New York Times Sunday. I was surprised. I always get the home paper on Sundays. And all about how the Patriots always win in Foxborough.
Yes, and the headline was great. It was like something, all I remember from it was Foxborough, spelled with just the O, and then in parentheses, UGH, so that it was also how sometimes they spell it, but also because
exactly.
It's so hard. It is really hard to play, and that is the question. Can the Patriots, and we've fallen into this trap with the Patriots before, they have this dominating win at home, and then everybody's like, they're back, they're going to the Super Bowl. I fell into it yesterday. I wrote in my note to my producers for our show yesterday, I'm not betting against them. We're going to Atlanta. Book it. And then when I sort of backed up a little bit, I thought, okay, well, hold on a second here. This is what we've seen from them before. They've played at home defensively really, really good. And Philip Rivers and the Chargers are the kind of offense that matches up well with the Patriots' defense because Phillip Rivers isn't very fast. Antonio Gates is a little bit older. Keenan Allen is a little bit older. He's not quite as fast. Now you look at Kansas City, and that is a whole different ballgame. Patrick Mahomes, if you haven't had a chance to watch him.
Do you know who he is? The new quarter, the kid quarterback. For
23 years old.
Maybe the most exciting quarterback I've ever seen.
The kid can sling it across his body 70 yards downfield. And I mean, they're fast. He's mobile. So my question is, if Brady has to match Patrick Mahomes pass for pass, not does Tom Brady have it, but does Tom Brady have the people around him that he can do it with?
My big problem with the game next week against Kansas City, as you know, Marjorie, it starts at 6:30. I try to go to bed by 8 o'clock every night. So I'm hoping I'm not going to miss the second half.
I know, it's preempting 60 minutes. I heard you guys talking yesterday with Bob Thompson about 60 minutes and said only like octogenarians watch. I DVR and watch 60 minutes every
night. Well, let me tell you, you watch the ads on that show?
Yeah, it's
true. It's all drugs.
Right, drugs for old people.
Headstones.
I also watch CBS Sunday Morning every morning.
What did you say? Headstones?
I said Sunday Morning.
Headstones.
But you know what? They always have a good, they usually have a really newsy opening thing. Like they had Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the week before. This week they had something else that was newsy. Who do they have this week?
I don't know.
But they usually have newsy.
Oh, it was Elijah Cummings.
Elijah Cummings, chair of the Oversight Committee.
Anyway, let's talk about, this is kind of exciting. This woman that's going to be officiating first ever in an NFL playoff game.
She did this past Sunday.
Yeah, that's right. The Sarah Thompson, Thomas person.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it's just another milestone for women in pro sports, right? The NBA has had women refs for a long time. Sarah Thomas was one of the first, and right now I still believe the only female. Actually, I think there's a second female official in the NFL, but she's the first to ever work a playoff game. And all these little steps they're monumental. Until it becomes commonplace, it is a huge step for women in
sports.
And
there were no complaints.
There were
no
complaints. No, she wasn't the lead official. She wasn't the guy with the microphone or anything like that. But there were no complaints. Nobody said that she doesn't know what she's doing. And sometimes you'll see things on Twitter, nasty stuff. I don't feel like, to me, it says a lot that she wasn't mentioned. She didn't factor into the game, which means she did her job.
Well, wait a second. Didn't she, I could be wrong about this, didn't she make the call on the play that ended the first half, which is the most controversial one, where Brady threw, the player seemed to be going out of bounds to stop the clock, which would have allowed them to kick a field goal, but the referee declared that because the player moved backwards, or was that her? We don't know.
I don't even remember.
Okay, fine. In any case, it's a hard.
I'm going to be honest. Once they went up like 32-0 or 32-7 or what it was in the first half, I almost didn't watch. I'm not even kidding. I almost didn't watch the second half. I almost watched Game of Thrones instead because it was such a boring game. I read the New York Times in the second half of the game.
Whoa, that's really deep. Now let me tell you something here.
I only half watched the second half of the game, so she made a big call at that point in the game. I was probably half watching.
Now don't get upset with this if you're all patrioted up because they're going to the championship game and then maybe on to the Super Bowl. But I am so with Ted Johnson on this. Ted Johnson is a former linebacker for the New England Patriots. I think he's won 3 Super Bowls with Brady.
Friend of Brady.
I emceed a bunch of dinners for the Concussion Legacy Foundation. And Ted Johnson spoke at one 2 years ago. One of the most moving, powerful, honest speeches about the injuries that happened to one's head during football. And he called out Tom Brady because Brady does seem to have these really odd, unproven notions about health because of his affiliation with this shyster character. What's his name?
Alex Guerrero.
And listen to what Ted Johnson had to say in an interview in your place, NBC Sports Boston, when he said that it was irresponsible for Brady to claim that his brain was, quote, wired for contact. Here it is.
It made me throw up in my mouth a little bit. It was, and I have to say it, it was very irresponsible for Tom to talk like that, okay? My brain's wired for contact. So what, Kevin Turner's wasn't? Junior Seau's wasn't? Justin Strelzniak's brain wasn't? Andre Waters' brain wasn't wired for contact, but yours is?
And the reason it matters is because his is not. Despite what Tom Brady says. And when he makes a comment like that, or we've had this discussion with you before, when he says he's fine with his kids playing contact football, even though LeBron James says, wait until my sons get out of high school, he's the highest profile athlete in the world, or at least in the United States. And when he makes a wired for contact comment, at least I think, Trenny, there's a kid or even a parent who says, well, if you train like Tom Brady, your brain can be wired for contact too.
Yeah, I have no problem with him pushing his pliability stuff. If you want to push that, you know, band exercises over heavy weights, lots of stretching, drinking water, you know, I mean, not getting a sunburn is a little weird when you say you drink a lot of water, but all of the other stuff, the benefits of health.
He says he doesn't get a sunburn?
Yes.
In his book, he claims, yeah, that if you drink a lot of water, he just doesn't get sunburned. I know.
That has not worked for me.
No, it has not. It's not worked. I drink more water than I could possibly consume, and yet I step out in the sun and I look like a stop sign. it is, to me, the best part about what Ted Johnson did was that finally somebody really called him out. And a former Patriot, someone who is friends with him.
That's
because a lot of times people talk around it. Well, you know, Tom does these things and that says, I don't agree with him. There's always a da-da-da-da-da but. This was no but. This was no if, no and, nothing. He called him out and said, and it is irresponsible with no data. There is no data to say that what he is doing, whether it's the brain exercises or learning how to,
what are brain exercises?
I think he just does like what a lot of us.
Crossword puzzles?
Right. Like, I think they're just, you know, isn't a major sponsor on all the, you know, NPR, like there isn't like a mind
game.
Those brain games.
Yeah, but they're not suggesting it insulates your brain
from physical contact. But I think he says that because he does all of those things, combined with the fact that he says he's more pliable, which most doctors and physical therapists will tell you is not even a real word. It's not a real term. That he's learned to absorb hits differently, that he's learned how to fall and get tackled better.
Well, all of that
protects his brain.
Oh.
But that is a dangerous place to go without any sort of medical science research. Again, I don't care if you want to talk about how, you know, I do all the TRX lunges and pull-ups and push-ups in the world, and that makes me a stronger, better quarterback, and the way that I eat has allowed me to play longer. Fine, none of that is going to kill somebody.
Yeah.
But when you're telling people that because I do brain exercises and I learn how to absorb a tackle better and because I drink a lot of water, that I'm not going to have any sort of CTE or brain damage when I'm older. And let's keep in mind, guys, he's only 41.
Right.
So what's happening to him? We don't know how he acts at home. We don't know if he has mood swings. We don't know if he has any sort of changes. We might not know that for another 5, 10, 15 years until he stopped playing football. And to me, that's just dangerous. It's highly, highly irresponsible. Like, even when I talk about mental health things and people reach out to me for advice on how they should deal with something, I'm always really careful to say, I am not a doctor. I would speak to your doctor about this. I don't know how this is going to work. Because what's to say that some kid or some parent someday doesn't come back and say, well, I did the TB12 method, and my kid had 6 concussions, and now he took his own life. I'm suing you, Tom Brady. Like, to me, it is so negligent. And it infuriates me that more people don't do what Ted Johnson does and stands up and says, this is wrong, shut your mouth about it.
Okay, so let's go to an upbeat story. Oh, I never heard, until yesterday afternoon, I never heard of Caitlin Ohashi.
Well, why would you?
Now, let me just say,
a UCLA gymnast.
I know that I am hyperbolic, but I'm going to really be that way here. I would argue the best minute-plus athletic performance I have ever seen.
Were you not grinning
in my whole
ear to ear?
Life.
Yeah.
It's not. This is a floor gymnast at UCLA. And if you haven't, it's hard to do this on the radio.
Ohashi,
yeah. O-H-A-S. If you Google a gymnast and UCLA,
yeah,
it'll come up right away.
It'll come up. She's
it's
great.
A minute-plus floor exercise, which beyond the fact she does things that I've never seen before, what really grabs you, I think, beyond her skills is it is the most joyful athletic experience.
I'm getting chills thinking about it
right now. I feel the same way. I mean, it is just, she is so full of life and happiness. But the reason we're talking about it is not just to urge you to go watch it, because probably most of you have, is if you read the Washington Post story on this, which you should, which includes the video, she talks about how life was when she was an Olympic candidate and the stresses and how unjoyful it was, and now that she's freed of all that and just does competition for the joy of competition, how it's so different.
So I was watching this and I thought to myself, I wonder if she could ever perform this routine on an international level. Like, it was so spunky. It combined all of this great sort of Motown, R&B, pop music from back in the 60s and 70s, and it just was so... Whose phone's ringing?
One of us.
Oh,
not me, thankfully.
Man, Marjorie.
Marjorie, you can take that call. Okay. That's
me.
Okay.
I watched it and thought, could she do that on the international level? Like, would she get? And then I remembered, and I can't remember the gymnast name, and I meant to look it up yesterday. I want to say Dominique Dawes, but that's not it. Remember when, and I think it was the 1996 Atlanta Olympics, there was that teeny little gymnast, I know they're all teeny, who did the really great floor routine to The Devil Came Down to Georgia. And it was one of the most spectacular performances I had ever seen in sports and gymnastics. And I grew up loving gymnastics. My sister was a high-level competitor. Oh, my really? Niece is a gymnast now. And it was so joyful and fun, and she won a gold medal, and it was so great. And it was so away from everything that we normally see in gymnastics, which is so rigid for these girls. Her joy, I could have watched that routine over and over and over again. I immediately sent it to my sister.
Well, what does this
say? Oh, Dominique Mochiano. I knew it was a Dominique. Thank you, Tori.
So basically this is saying, and she mentioned in one of these stories how she had a broken back at one point in her career. This is this UCLA gymnast,
Caitlin Ohashi.
So what does this say about the way gymnastics, for if you're an Olympian to be, works? It's just joyless and horrible, and
I mean,
don't smile.
I'm sure there are some gymnasts who find joy in it. But if you think about it, anything that is an individual sport at that kind of level, you are so isolated. You know, yeah. You look at tennis players and golfers and swimmers. Even though you're on a team, track runners, marathon runners, there is some joy taken out of the sport sometime when you're constantly, I run because I can, not because that's what I have, how I have to make my money. So for an Olympic gymnast, if you're training for a gold medal and to represent your country, and we, historically have very strong women's gymnastics teams in this country, the pressure is really high on you to perform. And so you're working through injuries constantly, and, you're practicing in the morning and at night. You guys probably aren't on Instagram, but the Team USA often does like a day in the life of Olympic athletes, and they did one on Katie Ledecky a couple weeks ago. She's a high-level swimmer. I mean, she gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning. She swims all morning. Then she has this highly regimented meal that they give her, and then she goes and gets treatment, and then she does strength training, and then she takes a nap, and then she goes back to the pool at night, and she works out again.
Oh, God.
And that's their entire life. Whereas maybe in college, you can at least have a little bit. You might have your off season or something. These Olympic hopefuls don't have off seasons.
Can I just say one more thing about this Ohashi thing before you move on? If you're listening to this and haven't seen the video yet, you may be saying to yourself, well, there are a lot of great athletes who did something great after which they show happiness. Of course there are. The beauty of this is while she is performing moves that I have never seen before.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
She is joyful amidst it. She's laughing. At one point, she sticks her tongue out.
Yes, she's
and she's
spunky.
About to do a flip. She is really, this kid is just spectacular.
And,
so go check it out.
In terms of her talent, we all remember that Simone
Biles.
Biles, mm-hmm. Yes, who won four Olympic gold medals, says that this young woman beat her in a competition. Now it was 5 or 6 years ago, but still, that shows a level of talent. This is not just some
and to think
old
about it, that it, she... Give her credit, I think, for deciding that, I want to do this because I love it, not to chase something. I mean, that's not an easy thing to do.
No.
Because if you find success at the Olympic level, you could be set for life. You'd never, you'll get speaking engagements and they'll put you on TV and you'll
Wheaties
be a Today
box.
Show, a Today Show correspondent. All this stuff that if you follow that path, but she chose... to go do it for the love of the sport.
And boy, does she do it. So Michael Phelps and you and a bunch of people in and around athletics have the courage to stand up and talk about mental health issues. I don't know enough to know if he gets celebrated for that because he deserves it or if he gets celebrated for that because people are so happy that someone that high up, the greatest swimmer arguably ever lived, does anything. Does he deserve the recognition he's getting?
It's a combination of both. Yeah, I do think he deserves the recognition he's getting. I just saw a commercial with him the other day.
Oh,
it was a lengthy commercial, and I can't remember what it was for, but it was almost like a PSA where he talked about, his depression and the importance of how he was in this dark hole and how once he got away from the pool, how important it was to talk about it and recognize it and break down stigmas. He has helped swimmers like Katie Ledecky who have dealt with mental health issues. They've gone to him. He has been someone within the athletic community that other athletes have reached out to, and many cite him as a guy who has taken the time to talk them through some of their darkest moments. So I think he absolutely deserves it. Does he get more attention than maybe, say, you know, a mental health advocate who's working the ground running?
Of course. Well, I'm fine with that if it's on the merits.
But I do think what he is doing, and I think he deserves it is because we don't necessarily see everything he's doing, but you hear about it later on. And a lot of people, especially celebrities, when they try to push a cause that they're passionate about, it's almost as much about pushing themselves as a brand as it is about, you know, doing something for other people. I think with Michael Phelps, he has balanced being the public face of depression and talking about it in the Olympic world with a nice juxtaposition of just being there for a lot of people quietly and only telling his own story, not using other people's stories to say, hey, look, I'm not the only one. And being really empathetic and cognizant of what other athletes deal with and what a sensitive topic it is.
By the way, the reason we even brought this up is a Boston connection. I'll read from the Associated Press story. The Boston-based Ruderman, R-U-D-E-R-M-A-N Family Foundation, a leading voice in calling for more opportunities for the disabled, said Tuesday that he was the recipient of the 5th Annual Morton E. Ruderman Award in Inclusion. And it's a Boston, as I said, Boston-based family foundation. So before you go, Clemson won the national championship. And I'm sure you've
Big
all seen
Macs
the photo
everybody.
Of Donald Trump standing in front of a table with about 4,000 fast food items. He is then asked, I would argue, a pretty important question. Which do you prefer, Mr. President, McDonald's or Wendy's? Here it is.
Now, what's your favorite thing here?
I like it all. It's all good stuff. Great American food. And it'll be very interesting to see at the end of this evening how many are left.
Do you prefer McDonald's or Wendy's?
I like them all.
That's a tough question.
If it's American, I like it. It's all American stuff.
It's a beautiful moment, I would argue, amidst all the chaos.
Well, you know, you got to give the guy some credit. I mean, he's 70 whatever years old he is, and he spent his whole life eating fast food.
Do you give him credit for that? Do you?
Well, I'm surprised he's not, you know,
dead?
Horizontal. You know, he seems to have a lot of
energy.
Well,
despite what Dr. Ronnie Johnson, or Jackson, what was his name?
Jackson
said, I mean, Donald Trump does not look wildly healthy.
Do you think he does? But he's an older guy. He doesn't work out. He doesn't exercise. So he's not, you know.
I mean, there must be some good genes, right? You have to have good genes for that.
Buffet, and they talk about how at Clemson they emphasize good eating for this football team.
Most major college programs have a nutritionist on staff to make sure these guys are getting, like, the right combination of protein and fats and carbs and macros and all these things.
Buffet with the Wendy's cheeseburgers and the Big Macs and the Burger Kings and about a million things of French fries.
Can I ask you guys a question? How much time do we have? I had a friend who texted me last night on this little group text chain around, and she said, does this feel racist to you? And
why?
I was like, and I think she thought because the Clemson football team is predominantly, you know, African American, that she felt and that some felt that maybe this was a... And I at first was like, I agree. And then more I thought about it, I thought, no, I just think he's a fat slob and he likes McDonald's.
Nicely put.
Well, he's a fast food kind of guy, that's for sure. Tony Kusinarik joins us every week. She's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. Thank you very much, Tony Kusinarik. Up next, is it time for Boston to overhaul how the fire and police departments hire? Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell joins us for that and more. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday from the Boston Public Library.
Boston Public Radio. A new report finds that Boston's fire department has a locker room culture that's creating a hostile environment for the 1% of female firefighters who work there. At noon, we'll talk to Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell about her plans to diversify both it and the city's police department. And remember when there was such a thing as the freshman 15? Well, Now it's the freshman famished. Food writer Corby Kummer joins us to talk about an epidemic of hunger on college campuses and how the government could be doing more to stop it.
Travel writer Christopher Muther has had it with the misguided guidebooks on Boston. He joins us to set the record straight and to dust off the cobwebs of the Boston Tea Party that seems to haunt every travel writer's review. We top things off with transplant surgeon Joshua Mesrick, whose new book traces the history and medical breakthroughs of using people's organs to save people's lives. All that is next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
You're going to say hello to me or what?
Hello, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
You know,
I
almost
distracted.
Didn't come back for the 12 o'clock segment because I was reading a story in the Globe that's relevant to our next guest.
Yep.
And the ad that popped up was that at IHOP through February 24th, all-you-can-eat pancakes are only $4.99. And I said,
what's that got to do with
No. The story has something to do with Andrea Campbell. But the ad that came up was the pancakes, and I had a hard time resisting.
Pancakes.
I'm going to wait till 2:30. Maybe we can go, City Council President. So only 1% of firefighters in Boston's fire department are women. And for them, the culture is hostile and dominated by, quote, male banter and locker room talk. That's what a recent report commissioned for city officials has concluded. One city official, in an effort to diversify the city's fire and police departments, is calling to overhaul how these public safety jobs are filled. The city official would be Andrea Campbell. She's president of the Boston City Council. She represents District 4, and she joins us every month. Andrea Campbell, it's good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, and Happy New Year
Happy
to
New
you
Year
guys.
To you too.
Thanks for having me back.
Thank you very much for coming in. You know, maybe because I'm older than you and I've been reading the same thing for years and years and years, you know, that there's almost no women at all on the firefighters, not very many women on the cops. This is a majority-minority city. We still have like 70% of the fire department is white, 67% of the cops are white. We never seem to get anywhere. So you have proposed an overhaul of how we hire firefighters and cops in the city of public safety jobs. Tell us about it.
I mean, I think you said it best. You know, Boston is increasingly becoming a more cultural and multilingual and multicultural city. We know that the majority of the population is women. And we know that diversity in our public safety jobs is important, especially not just in public safety, across the entire city of Boston, right, in all of our departments. But specifically looking at public safety, you know, it builds trust. People and community have been asking for their public safety agencies to be reflective of the demographics in the city of Boston for a really long time. And so I put out this report that calls out the numbers, that looks at not just the fire department by itself. I said we need to look at all of these public safety agencies together. That includes our EMS department, fire, and police together. If you look at the numbers, over 2,000 officers in BPD, 67% are white, 13% are female. Over 1,500 firefighters in the city of Boston, 72% are white, 1% female. EMS technicians, 68% are white, 32% are female. But I think the numbers that often are not talked about is when you move up, when you look at the top tier ranks. So if you look at our BPD department, 121 of our lieutenants, the captains, the superintendents, 86% are white, 7% are female. Go to the fire department, 367 deputies and captains and district chiefs and so on, 83% are white, less than 1% are female. EMS chiefs, 44 chiefs, superintendents, and captains at EMS, 73% are white, 20% are female.
So what do you want
to
do about
it? So I said we could be doing a couple of things. One, the cadet program for the fire department, which is similar to the police department, has demonstrated that increases our number in people of color. We need to actually resource our diversity officers. We have a diversity officer for BPD, one for the fire department. They have no budget. They have no human capital or staff. That's a problem if we want to say they should be doing this job and outreach better. Civil service. That is the elephant in the room. That is the hiring guidelines and the process by which governs the city of Boston. I've been talking about this for over a year. We absolutely need to study the civil service process and the effect it has on our agencies. We have some folks in the departments that say it's civil service that hinders our ability to increase the number of women and people of color. Some are saying maybe not. So I said, let's study it. Look at the pros and cons of this system. It covers our cost to do the exams. It covers our cost of arbitration. That's a good thing. The cons might be it doesn't allow us to actually hire homegrown talent, folks who are born and raised in the city, who are women, who are people of color. And so we have to do better. And so this report lays out 10 recommendations. But I think we have to paint the picture in a more honest way by looking at those numbers and making it available and then also take some action.
Last Friday, the mayor was here, and we talked to him about you and your concerns about this and concerns that arose just from the report itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fair to say that his reaction, his response on I know you're not suggesting getting rid of civil service, but a major fix is he's not interested in doing. I think his answer was no, one word. I think you'd agree. This would have to be a home rule petition, right? That would have to go to the State House, yes?
That's right. You'd have to go to the State House.
I think you would agree the State House would not be very supportive of a dramatic rewrite of civil service, would you not think?
I don't know that. You know, there are several municipalities now in Massachusetts that have opted out of civil service for their fire departments and their police departments.
With the sign-off by the state?
Yes, all through home rule petitions.
And what's their argument that I mean, obviously the mayor's got to be on board or it never gets there, but putting aside Marty Walsh for a second, what's the argument in these other communities that was compelling to the legislature?
Well, I'll say two things. I don't know that the mayor has to be on board. You know, we've been talking back and forth, and I'll say to the mayor, agree to disagree. If we want to change these numbers for women and people of color, we have to be bold, we have to be courageous, and we have to actually identify all of the allies, and there are many, including veterans, who say maybe we should look at this system. Other communities that have done this, have done studies, have talked internally, have talked to their unions, have talked to veterans organizations, have brought all of the stakeholders to the table to say, we're not getting parity with the demographics of the city of our city or our town.
What are some of those places, do you know?
Burlington, East Hampton. Mm-hmm. Right now, East Hampton is in conversations with their fire department. They've opted out for police. The chief of Burlington, Michael Kent, I have a call set up with him. He's actually cited in my report that I put out. He said, we're not getting the best of the best through this process. And so they, through several conversations, opted out. So I am looking to these other communities to say, what approach did you take? And saying, how can we do the same here in Boston? But to not talk about it, to not do something, is a huge mistake if we say we are serious about diversity in our public safety agencies.
Well, you know, it's fairly obvious that we're not serious. I mean, this thing about the firefighters, which is a total disgrace, and the women were talking about locker room talk and sexual harassment and how there's, like, there would be one woman firefighter in this whole house full of male firefighters. I mean, we're not serious about it. And this is the third time we've heard about the fire department with these problems for women firefighters. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The new class has got, like, one woman in the whole thing.
By the way, just and I'm not defending anybody's position, but just what the mayor told us the other day is there were three, and then for whatever reason it dropped down to one. But I hope he would agree that three in a class, what is it, a 54 or something
about that,
is totally inadequate considering how far behind the city is.
We have more work to do. And when we were all briefed on this report that came out, external law firm did the report. Every councilor and the mayor was there, and we were briefed. We said, this isn't enough. It doesn't go far enough. And it doesn't. We have to do more, not just to diversify our agencies, but also talk about the culture within these agencies. Across all of our departments that have maybe for a long time been predominantly white. And not assume that those employees that identify as white don't want to be a part of the solution and making sure that there is a culture that welcomes everyone. They do. But I will add, when I was walking out of that briefing, when we were getting the report, I said to the attorney, I said, this report just...
It's Kay Hodge. You were
Kay Hodge. Yeah. This only focused on women in the fire department. I said, how can we possibly do what is necessary to diversify our ranks or do better with respect to the culture without talking about the people of color or lack thereof? And she agreed. You can't do this work well without talking about people of color. But the scope of her investigation was limited to women in the fire department. And that's not enough. And I think I've been talking with other colleagues about this, including Councillor Edwards, who cares deeply about this issue and has been following this and having direct conversations with women at the fire department who were involved. We pulled in Councillor Zakim, and the three of us filed a hearing order recently to set up a commission to begin to look at systemic bias within these departments. And frankly saying, if the mayor or the city council call for an independent investigation after we found some troubling behavior at our departments, we need to turn this over to an independent commission that says, okay, who should we hire to run these investigations? What's the standards by which we should be doing these investigations? Who's responsible for making sure that these recommendations that come out of the report are actually delivered to everyone in a timely manner and you don't have to search for it? How do we make sure that the recommendations and the policy changes that a report actually gives us, that we hold the departments accountable to those recommendations? So we're continuing this and saying we have to do better.
Well, the other thing that seems so obvious to me, and I don't understand, I know we talk about this all the time, the veterans preference thing, and everybody gets that, people put their lives on the line. But it particularly with cops, it seems to me it's so important to have people that grew up in Boston, live in Boston, as police officers. And I guess I don't understand why Boston residents can't be bumped up, that doesn't matter more, so that you don't have people from East Overshoe coming in here and being cops and firefighters. Plus, they're really good jobs. You make a good salary. They're great jobs, very middle-class jobs.
And I agree. So my goal is not to go out there and say I alone should determine how we shift the civil service process. This is a process that involves many stakeholders, and everyone should be at the table, and someone should take on this independent study. And in that, we can talk about what, if we want more people who are born and raised in the city of Boston, should we flip the preference? Should the preference first be Boston residents and then veteran preference? That's an idea and a solution that we could absolutely do. Or should it be something else? But this conversation will be and has never been, from me, a conversation to pit women or veterans of color or veterans against people of color. The system isn't working for a lot of folks, and we have to do better if we say we want more women, more people of color, more folks who are born and raised here. And also I'll add, I don't think the only pathway to become a firefighter in the city of Boston should be a military pathway. I don't believe that you should have to go to war or sign up and then come back in order to be a firefighter. I think we have to think of more pathways, and that's what I'm hoping the conversation and the study will bring.
I know you will not agree with this, but it sort of feel about this like Marjorie, when Marjorie said they're not serious about it. How Marjorie says, when you talk about extended day, and we say we've been talking about extended day since we went on the radio and before 19 years ago, there is nothing in this report. We said this to the mayor the other day. There's nothing in this report, other than maybe some updated statistics, that every single one of the stakeholders didn't know before the report came out. And it's almost like, what's the name of the guy in Casablanca? I'm shocked, Rick, that gambling is going on. So if the disappointment, which is probably a euphemism for how people reacted in the past to numbers like these, produced very little. And the mayor is doing some things about sleeping quarters and trying to get the cadet program going in the fire department. I have no idea why it's not already.
That's right.
Why should we assume that this time is not going to be deja vu all over again?
Oh, I think a couple of reasons.
No, I'm serious. I don't mean that to be disrespectful to you, but there have been a lot of serious
people.
And I don't
receive it as such, fine. I will tell you, because one, you have different leadership on the council, and I'm proud to say that. Not just me, you have others who have joined this council, including more women, and who are saying, we're not wasting any more time. We want to get things done. We don't want to keep talking about it. And we also have the advocates. You know, whether it's Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, MAMLEO, the Vulcans, ACLU, however you feel about these various organizations, all of them have been showing up for decades to talk about doing something more. And I think now you have partners at the council level who are saying, let's finally do something in partnership. And so I'm excited to turn this into something. And I don't like wasting my time. I tell folks all the time, I have a 16-month-old, I was in the private sector for a little bit. Every 6 minutes was money. I don't like wasting time. I take that same work ethic into public service because people deserve us to take action and not just talk about
Speaking
it.
Of
Can I
action,
ask one more question before
yeah,
we move
then
on?
We got to move on.
Okay. Why does the state have anything to do with how Boston organizes its cops and firefighters and EMT? Why do we have to go up to ask permission from Beacon
And
Hill?
That's through the civil service process that was started decades
ago. Yeah, that's
ago.
Another ridiculous thing.
And part
thing.
Of it, I mean, civil service, in talking about the
Nepotism,
pros.
Nepotism, yes.
Right, but, right. I mean, you could just pick up the phone. Yeah. It was who you knew to get a job. Yeah. And so this was to get around that to create some sense of fairness. But if you have folks who are scoring 100 on their exam and someone who's scoring maybe a 70, they're saying, wait a minute, why am I not making it? So we have to have serious conversations about is it the most fair process and does it afford opportunity to everyone, not just our disabled vets, not just our veterans, women, people of color, and anyone else who's born and raised in this city who's interested in getting one of these good, high-paying jobs.
We're talking to Andrea Campbell, who's president of Boston City Council. By the way, it's not just civil service, because the next topic we want to broach with you also requires a home rule petition mm-hmm. and state approval. This notion about assessing a higher real estate transfer tax on high-priced sales with some exemptions. I think this came out of the Chuck Collins report. We had Chuck on with us.
Yeah, he's great.
Talking about these transfers to big investors buying expensive properties here, crowding out the affordability of people who live here and that sort of housing. For starters, tell us what some of you are contemplating advancing on the Boston City Council.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we've been talking about how the lack of affordable housing units in the city of Boston, particularly for those who are working two or three jobs, our veterans, our seniors. Affordability is a major issue in the city. People are getting displaced. So we're having different conversations at the council. I want to applaud Councillor Edwards and Councillor Janey, who've just put forth a proposal to talk about whether or not we should be assessing a fee of some sort on those who are buying units above $2 million or buying a unit and then transferring it or flipping it within a couple of years.
Twice in 2 years, yeah.
So it's a conversation I think is an idea worth discussing at the council. I think we need to be discussing all creative ideas that are out there. Some other folks have done this, and I'm excited to participate in these conversations. I support the idea. But I think it also, of course, has to be holistic and balanced, and we have to do it in partnership with the mayor. One of the things that I think I struggle with in being council president is, you know, we have the mayor who has his housing agenda. He has a legislative package gone up to the state house with things in there that we haven't reviewed just yet. So how do we work together for all of our residents on all these issues that we say we care about? We want our downtown areas to, of course, keep booming, but we want all of that economic prosperity to be shared across every single neighborhood. Right?
How does Walsh feel about this?
I have no idea. You have to ask Mayor Walsh.
Well, you could ask Mayor Walsh.
I don't know yet. I do know that he has his own plans related to housing that I think there's some good ideas. How do we talk together?
That's but, you know, well, his housing person said she hadn't read it yet, so
Sheila
she couldn't
Dillon.
Comment in the Globe.
But the point that Marjorie made about these home rule petitions, I know you're probably not the person to ask, but we will anyway. We should be asking Charlie Baker, who will be here Thursday, or Karen Spilker, or Bob DeLeo, the three leaders on Beacon Hill. Why should Boston not be able to decide with its duly elected city council and its mayor whether it wants to up the transfer tax from whatever it is, 0.5% to 2 or 4 or 6? Or why is it the why is it the business of a state rep from Northampton what you decide to do in your city?
That's a major issue, and I would encourage you to take that on and to raise that question, but it's a major issue for every municipality. We have the home rule process that goes back to a history of distrust between, you know, in Boston in particular, the Brahmin and the Irish, and whether or not the folks in the state house want to give power to the local folks. But it does hinder our ability to effectively impact change in our communities. So we're even changing our speed limit, we have to go to the state house.
It's ridiculous. Didn't I read, though, that I think he's my state rep, Connolly. Didn't he propose a local option situation say that in specific areas like real estate transfer taxes, individual cities and towns can small-d democratically make the decision for themselves?
That's right.
Of course, that's going nowhere as of the
But I will tell you, what I have learned, given this new role as council president, is In talking to whether it's the speaker or other leadership or other state reps in the Boston delegation or our state senators, is they want to work with us and they want to help us pass home rule legislation and petitions. They like to usually get a heads up. They like to have a conversation about it. Sometimes folks are at the state house doing or working on the same issue. And so we're beginning to come together around some of these issues and say, how do we work together? Even around some things related to our elections. And our election processes, having conversations with the State House, because we can't do this work without them. And we are having those conversations. I'm having them on behalf of the council and asking my counselors what are their priorities and how do we work together to move some of this stuff at the State House.
Is Mayor Walsh, I mean, you mentioned politely that he's on one course, you're another course, and you hope that twain meets. What I read into that is there's not as much consultation with by the mayor with you guys on some critical issues like housing agendas. Is that a fair statement?
I want it to be better. I think we are all in this together. We all represent the same, usually, you know, the same constituencies. And we only actually get things done when we come together and have dialogue. I understand this is a strong mayor city, but we're all better as residents, as elected officials, when we open up our spaces to just include more dialogue.
Can we move to a topic which does not require approval from the people in Beacon Hill? We discussed this with the mayor the other day, and I think we discussed it with Paul Revel as well, the former Secretary of Education for Massachusetts. This decision in Boston to make operative the policy that when you hit 22, the obligation of the Boston Public Schools to you disappears. Where are you on this? The mayor said to us the other day that we're trying to work out some sort of deal. Where are you and where is the deal?
So I'm not sure where the deal is. I know that I, along with Councillor Asabi George and Councillor Janey, following a hearing we did about our off-track youth, you know, those students who are not graduating meeting all the standards they should, or those students who are still in our system and not reading and writing at the level they should, we need to do more for those young people. And at that hearing, there were a group of students from one particular school that were saying they're really disturbed by this idea of pushing out these students who were close to graduating. And we were also disturbed. So Councillor Asabi George, Janey, and I put forth a letter, and we sent it to the interim superintendent and said, we need to talk about this. We don't think these students should be pushed out. They're almost done. You have teachers, a principal, that are dedicated to these students and helping them. We know the power of education, and a good one. So why put them out? We're on the street. Where are they going to go? And not transition them more gracefully. So we're hoping to continue that conversation.
What'd you hear back?
I know. So they were in dialogue at the school, at BPS.
And is this all about money? You know, we assume, Marjorie and I think I'm speaking for Marjorie, we assume this is all about money. But when you read the original Globe story, it had this notion that I found a bit odd, even though I'm not in the educating business, or at least in a public school, I guess you could say, is that there was concern that people who were old enough to drink would be going to school with people who weren't, which to me seemed ridiculous.
I don't know what that is.
So is it about money?
I don't know. So Councillor Asabi George just called for a hearing. She just put out a hearing order to discuss this and have a conversation about it. Because all we've heard is that they're thinking about enforcing this policy of transitioning these students out. And we said, well, wait a minute. Who have you talked to? What students, what teachers? And what impact will this have on the students if we do that? And so she called for this hearing. I will participate in that. I don't know that it's money. I don't know what it is. All I do know is that these students and these families need supports. And for us to serve them well, they have to be transitioned out. And frankly, they have to graduate. And so that's what this conversation is all about.
Well, but right now, I think, I don't want to speak for Paul Revel, but I think his answer to us when we talked about it was they'd be transitioning to nothing. Because there aren't adequate adult education opportunities, which is, he believes, is an area where the state's got to do a little bit better job, not just vis-a-vis Boston, but vis-a-vis all of older students.
And I will add, you know, in the hearing we'll get more data on this, but I don't think it's a large number of students that we're talking about. And so we have to really have a plan around this and think about it, a creative way to support these families and these students.
Fair enough.
You know, I should know this, but I don't. Where were you on Amazon coming to town?
Oh, I I said that I think we need to have more robust conversations with an Amazon and anyone else about all of the major issues facing our city. So yeah. We talk about housing, transportation access. I live in Mattapan. My neighborhood that I represent is Mattapan, a little bit of Dorchester. My folks want equitable access to a good transit system to get to jobs. If you put an Amazon in the seaport, my question is, what about my people over here? So you bring in a billion-dollar company that may be well on its way to become a trillion-dollar company. I want them to help us on the pressing issues in the city of Boston. And so I just approach the conversation a little differently.
Okay. Also, I mean, do you really want Jeff Bezos sexting from downtown Boston? I think the answer is, I mean, I for one think the answer, do you have an opinion on that?
Although Mrs. Bezos.
I'm going nowhere near
okay,
that.
Okay, fine.
How much is Mrs. Bezos going to get? They were married for 25.
$69 billion.
$69 billion. You know, you could squeeze by on that,
it's interesting.
I think.
All of a sudden, the city council president is speechless. She's never been speechless.
$69 billion.
In our presence before.
$1 billion.
But you know, I always say, in government, the thing that frustrates me is the amount of time we waste and the amount of resources we waste in not helping people.
Yeah.
You think about a company like Amazon or many other companies and the wealth of resources, human capital, expertise that they have to help us solve these issues. And we could do this probably overnight with
okay.
respect to
nice
things.
Nice job changing
yes.
the subject. Before you go, do you read trash like Marjorie and I do, or do you not?
Do I read
Do you
trash?
Read all these trashy stories in the newspaper?
No.
In your home? You really don't?
See, she's above it all.
Oh, she's.
No, no, not that. Who has time? No.
Well, we're pretty
time?
Busy, too. We're reading every one
I
of them.
I like to go on Pinterest and, like, search yeah. the images of nice.
I must say. I
nice
look at
clothing
the Bezos.
And.
We're reading about Jeff
And I'm thinking
Bezos.
About doing over my kitchen.
You are.
I want
so
my
nice
husband
to
do over my kitchen
I
and
bet
looking
you
at
do.
Pictures of that.
How okay, about that
fine.
Marie
Who has
Kondo?
Time?
How about the Marie Kondo?
There's a story in the Globe about
Cleaning
it
Up
today.
Your House. Yeah. A person that's on. She's on television now. She had this book before, The Magic of Cleaning Up Your House.
I love her.
I don't know if you're neat. Are you neat?
Very.
Oh, you're very sure. neat. Okay, then you don't need it. So I need it. And she talks about things like, you know, throwing things out that you're, especially sentimental
Read
things.
Read the Globe today. It's online right now.
That you thank the piece of clothing or the picture for its service. You tell it you love it, and then you get rid of it.
Okay.
Nice and I also it. Don't keep a lot of stuff. You
oh,
know,
good just, for you. So yeah. how did you get like that? Have you been like that your whole life?
No, I think, you know, college, it's at some point you keep moving and you're like, you can't bring all this stuff with you. And then you think, do you really need all this stuff?
Ooh,
you know,
so you're
there's a great, you know, there's a great comic strip on that, you know, stuff.
Stuff.
Google that stuff.
So you're a decluttered
Marjorie.
Person.
We gotta go. You know
I know, but I
find
that thank you guys.
2:30. Okay,
these
nice
are the important
issues.
Pancakes on you.
Yeah.
For $4.99, I can
thank
handle
you
it.
Guys. Yeah.
See
Happy
you
New Year.
Thank
to
you very
you.
Much. Andrea Campbell joins us every month. She's president of the Boston City Council representing District 4. Andrea, thank you very much again for coming in. I'm impressed that you're a decluttered person. I wish I was a decluttered
so
person.
Anyways.
Coming up next, no shoes, no shirt, no service. A restaurant where the customers are in the buff has gone belly up. It turns out people do not like dining in the nude. Food writer Corby Comer joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. American farmers, already hurt by the U.S.-China trade war, are preparing for more pain ahead thanks to the government shutdown. That's because they won't be getting their insurance checks. This is unbelievable. To help them deal with the trade war's financial blow. Joining us to talk about this, how the government shutdown is affecting food safety and other headlines about food culture and food policy is Corby Comer. Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic, senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Hey there, Corby.
Hey there.
Great to talk to you, Corby, as always. So let's start with the government shutdown. The article in the New York Times describes the shutdown as a sucker punch for farmers who are already struggling. What's happening?
This is so good. It is a guy who's news director for an Iowa radio station. And what he's pointing out is, remember, we talked about the $12 billion bailout that Trump promised farmers hit by his dumb, senseless tariffs and the trade war in China that was, you know, he was holding American taxpayers ransom. as he is now with a shutdown for $12 billion in damage and lost sales of soybeans and other huge crops to foreign markets that farmers in the U.S. relied on, and essentially subjecting them to years of losses for lost contracts when these other countries in Europe and China just looked to other competitor producers and said, we're going to contract with you for a couple of years, so too bad, U.S. farmers. Well, now those farmers can't even get those checks because of the shutdown. So they can't apply to that. They're not getting those checks. They're completely paralyzed also by the lost market and not being able to get loans.
So what are they going to do?
They wait, like everybody else. They're just waiting. By the shutdown.
They've been completely screwed, and this blundering crisis, as the Iowa writer says. What's going to happen? Big Ag is going to swoop in and buy up farms that are going to go into receivership and decide, throw in the towel, have to sell because we've got one punch after another and we just aren't going to get up again. And as happened in the farm crisis of the 1980s, we are looking at the loss of a new generation of farmers.
You know, I am so glad you said that, by the way, because the immediate takeaway from this story is the short-term impact, which is horrible on these family farmers. But the long-term impact, it's almost as if it's a conscious act as opposed to being oblivious to the pain that's being caused to so many individuals by this shutdown. But here, an end is achieved that may be one that is supported by those responsible for the shutdown, the disappearance of the family farm and the expansion of the agribusiness. No, Corey?
Yeah, deliberate or not, it's just a gift to Big Ag, the consolidation of agriculture that's been underway for decades anyway.
By the way, a friend of mine and yours, Marjorie, runs a place called Farm Aid. And if you want to read about the importance of the family farmer in American life and also the pain being caused to the family farmer by so many policies coming out of Washington, go check out their website, farmaid.org.
So, Corby Kummer, apparently we're not supposed to panic because the shutdown is not making food unsafe. I read this story and then I discovered that the FDA only inspects most plants once every few years. And I thought, wow, maybe I should be in a panic all the time then.
Well, you probably should be. So, first of all, there's this historically intractable division of inspection. USDA, the Department of Agriculture, inspects fresh meat, and they have not been ceasing their inspections.
That's good.
Mostly because, as with everything, slaughterhouses don't want to be left with uninspected food and then have a crisis and lose business. But the FDA, which does all non-meat inspections, lets 99% of its workers, its factories, its 80,000 factories, go uninspected for years at a time because it's this huge burden and they just don't have time manpower or womanpower to inspect anything other than these 99% more than once every few years.
So wait a second. So let me restate what Marjorie said. It's not that we should feel assured that our food is safe. We should feel assured that it's no less safe than it is any other time because the inspections are so infrequent. I was stunned by Marjorie was stunned by.
Oh, every few years. Once every 5 years they show up. Boy, a lot of damage could be done between 2018 and 2023.
Corby, when those very rare inspections happen, does the manufacturer or producer know in advance that the inspector is coming, or are they surprise inspections?
No, and that's very important. It's the whole idea that you could be surprised any day and then fined or shamed publicly if you're in trouble. Therefore, a lot of food industries have voluntary inspections. So they have their own programs, and they say no, since the FDA isn't particularly vigilant, doesn't have that many inspectors, we're going to have our own program. As happened with, for example, lettuce. Lettuce and leafy greens are a big, important example in the past year of huge recalls.
Yeah.
Like the national recall of romaine. That industry knows it's in trouble because there aren't enough inspectors available from the FDA, which is what does those leafy greens and other non-meat products. So they institute their own voluntary programs. The problem is they're not that vigilant. And so even with, you know, very good voluntary inspection programs in place, Western Arizona had this big leafy green scare and foodborne illness outbreak last fall.
So, Corby Comer, this is a sad story. People may know Haley House. It's in Dudley Square. It's been there, I think, 2005 is when it started. It's shutting down because it can't make ends meet. Tell people what it is.
So it's temporary, and what's going on. I love Haley House. Have both of you been?
I've been
to
there.
Yes, yes.
Right across from the Morgan Memorial.
Exactly.
So they're a great food service organization that since 1966 have been providing food aid classes to people. And they had this great cafe that was a big, airy, open, exposed brick place. They were able to buy that building in 2015. And they had a cafe that served healthy food. It employed returning convicts, returning citizens, as they're called. It gave them food service jobs and training. It was a great gathering place for Dudley Square. And I would, when I was teaching at Northeastern, I would take groups of students just for a tour of the place and talks with their really dynamic trainers. It was a great place. And Bing Broderick is the guy who really set it in motion and has been is now going to look actively for new plans to reopen it. And I emailed him my condolences, and he said, nope, we're going to reinvent ourselves and we're going to be back.
What does that mean, reinvent ourselves?
It means figure out how they can try to lose less money and reopen.
Well, isn't it you can just give, you don't pay full price, you can just give a donation or something?
I think at Haley House you could give a donation, but it wasn't like the charitable restaurants like Panera has,
yep.
Panera Cares, where you pay whatever you want. In this case, there was a floor price. It just wasn't covering the expenses of labor and the heat and the light.
We're talking to Corby Comer. Corby, we're going to take a rare moment to say something very good about the Supreme Court of the United States, which declined to hear challenges to these animal welfare laws that were passed by voters in California and the one here. And if people don't remember, I think it was 2016 here, where the voters, it was overwhelming, almost 80 to 20, said that you can't sell hens, the product of hens or pigs and some other animal, I'm not sure, if they can't, you know, lie down, move around. I mean, it's good, but it's pathetic that this is the level, this is the best we can do. They have to be able to fully extend their limbs and that sort of thing. And essentially, they were challenged by industry officials. And in both these cases, Massachusetts and California, the animal welfare rights things, for lack of a better expression, were upheld. Am I not correct about that?
So this is really important because California got there first in 2008 with a ballot initiative called Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act, which indeed mandated space for animals, humane treatment. And what happened, the states around California said, you know, fine, we're just going to undersell Californians. And the California legislature, to protect California egg raisers and animal producers, said, we're not going to allow the sale. So these carpetbaggers from out of state can't come in and undercut our markets because they have to certify, too, that they upheld the same standards that our 2008 ballot initiative mandated. And so these challenges have been working their way up the courts for years because trade associations in other states hate them because they force them, out-of-state producers, both out-of-state Massachusetts and California, to spend money on giving space to animals, more personnel that will treat the animals better. They don't want to be subject to these, you know, whimsical, liberal, blue states that decide we care about animal welfare. So I think it's great that for whatever reason, Supreme Court decided we're not going to hear these challenges from trade associations. We're just going to let the law stand.
And by the way, I think the Massachusetts ballot law, correct me if I'm wrong, Corby, did in its original form what California did, I guess, as an amendment. I believe that our law speaks to the sale of products from pigs and hens.
Right, it did, because it was 8 years later.
regardless
and they,
of where they
learned
come
from California.
Okay. That's great, actually. The Supreme Court rules on behalf, I would say, of the
Do we know where Judge Kavanaugh
there.
Was on this? Was he for the
he was
freeing
actually
the chickens?
He was at the bar when the decision was made, so
he was on
I like beer.
That particular time. Okay, like beer.
He was at the bar. He liked the beer.
Okay.
Corby Cummer, so...
Oh, no, they declined to hear the challenge. So I don't know if we actually know... What the I don't know if there's a roll call taken, but the court.
Okay,
as
so we
a whole
don't know.
Declined the
we
challenge.
Don't know what Kavanaugh
think
thinks
do,
about
no.
chickens yet.
No,
we may find out going forward what he thinks about chickens and foie gras. One of those words I have very difficult.
You said it well.
Time
you just
saying.
Did very well.
Beautifully,
it's a
yeah.
struggle for me. Anyway, Corby, another shocking story about so many college students hungry.
This is one of the great issues of our time. There are so many reasons that so many students are suffering from food insecurity, not quite knowing how they're going to afford their next meals or having sleep for supper, as one heartbreaking student post in another story about this said. So there's lots of reasons that 2 million college students who are eligible for food stamps aren't getting them. First, the fact of why they're hungry. It's that the ironic result of increased access for lower-income students to higher education means that there are many more hungry students. Why? Because students who would rely on free supplemental lunch programs, there's never been that safety net in colleges. Colleges were traditionally the province of the elite. White-collar families didn't have to worry about hunger, so there was never any national need to provide some kind of safety net to give students food so that they could study, as we all know is absolutely essential for elementary school and high school students. But that hasn't existed. And since 1975, the number of low-income high school graduates in college has more than doubled. And so this hunger is a really important issue. Students don't know that they're eligible for SNAP, and what's worse is there's this catch-22. So if students, because SNAP rules vary state by state. So, for example, in New York, this article in New Food Economy gave an example. A City University of New York student is earning less than $12,000 a year, so absolutely she thought she qualified for SNAP. But in New York, the college aid program says that you're only allowed to work 17 hours a week. But in New York State, you have to work at least 20 hours weekly to be a student who can get SNAP. So she's unable to get SNAP. And her teachers, including Janet Poppendick, who studies student hunger and has for decades, says, I don't want my students working 20 hours a week. You know, this is a terrible rule.
So what is the response of universities, since you work at one, when was the story about Northeastern's dorm in the Globe the other day where it's what,
the high-end
$2,300
yeah,
a unit
I know.
Or whatever? So in addition to the tuition and fees and textbooks that cost $300 a piece to go, universities, some, not all, go out of their way to make it college even more affordable where you do have to choose between school
books.
And sleeping and books and food. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me that there seems to be such colossal insensitivity. And by the way, the meal plans at a lot of these joints are really, really expensive as well, are they not?
They're very expensive, and part of that is that colleges see food as an incentive and a recruiting tool. So when you go on college tours,
that's
you're
true.
Often given the huge choice of allergen-free foods, the separate production lines that allow non-allergenic foods, and organic and sustainable. And you know, it's great that colleges offer that, but they are going to have to step up to offer more assistance. And, you know, some colleges locally are instituting quietly food pantries and food banks. And they have, like, secret hidden bookshelf entrances so that other students don't see them, and it reduces the stigma. But that's kind of a Band-Aid now. There has to be some kind of systemic addressing.
So we'll charge you $60,000 to go here, but we'll have a food pantry on the backside of the dorm. It's obscene. You know, speaking of obscene, I really worry. When I read that Mario Batali, who most people know that after he was outed for his sexual misconduct, decided to apologize with a recipe for a cinnamon bun or whatever it was at the end
it was
of
pizza dough. Good, pizza dough, whatever.
Yeah, not just a good taste kind of thing.
So it appears that whatever charges were being considered against Patali, I think there were three, have disappeared, which makes me very nervous, even though I know the cases are not connected, that even Harvey Weinstein, some of whose charges have disappeared, could also walk free. Does the fact that there are no pending criminal charges against Mario Batali, and obviously we've all heard about this so-called rape room that he in part was an investor in, does this mean that he'll be welcomed back into the industry you cover because he was not cleared but not prosecuted, or does he continue to be tainted goods, I hope?
I don't think he's ever going to be welcomed back. New York Magazine did a really well-reported and long story about him just a few weeks ago, in which the reporter went out to northern Michigan, where he has a family home. And all of his sources, the New York Magazine reporter sources, had said, you're never going to find Mario. He's in Europe. He's in South America. He's in Australia. And there he was at his lakeside home. And he was very nice to the guy, and he said, not going to talk to you. I don't live in public anymore. And at the end, he gave the reporter a plate of food and made sure that he got food. But that was that. He's not going to be back in the food industry. But what this points out, the dropping of the cases, is how hard it is to get evidence. Women don't remember. They admit that they were drunk. They're unable to provide sufficient evidence for investigators and prosecuting attorneys to go on. And, you know, that's why, for example, the Manhattan district attorney was given hell for not prosecuting Harvey Weinstein when there had been a complaint a year before the New York Times published its Pulitzer Prize-winning story. But again, there wasn't evidence. And in fact, those cases are one by one being dismissed.
Well, can I interrupt you? Due respect, I do not agree. We're talking about Cy Vance, correct? The Manhattan
yes.
DA? I do not. I mean, Cy Vance is the one who also refused to prosecute the Trump kids for what on its face seemed to be clear criminal acts vis-a-vis this Trump Soho
Grand
or whatever
Hotel.
The hell it was, where they're misrepresenting
well,
things.
Well, it's also statute of limitations, if
he,
you mentioned that.
Right, and he refused to prosecute Weinstein, where there was not a statute of limitations problem, at least on one count, where the woman had the tape. She had an audio recording of him groping her against her will. And correct me if I'm wrong, either of you, he decided not to prosecute that case, even though on its face, at minimum, in my estimation, there was enough to go to a jury. And if a jury decides to acquit, they decide to acquit. So I would have to say his history is going after people who don't deserve to be gone after, like that Abacus, that Chinese-owned bank in Chinatown in New York City.
Oh, yeah, the only bank prosecuted after
right,
the 2600th
biggest
disaster.
Bank in America.
Yeah.
And failure to prosecute people who deserve to be prosecuted. Is that? I think that's...
Well, first of all, I don't remember what evidence he had or ignored for Weinstein that he refused to prosecute. I do know that he wins hundreds of millions of dollars against the finance industry, because that's in Manhattan, and he decides what he wants to do with that money, and that has involved building basketball courts and athletic facilities at schools to prevent students from going into the drug trade, and it has worked. So everything is mixed picture.
Well, let's talk before we go about this nudist restaurant in Paris. Apparently, it lasted, I think, 15 months, and they're shutting it down because not enough people want to dine in the nude, which is probably a very good thing.
A good
Were
thing
you there?
For everybody.
Were you
yeah.
there or no, Corby? You've been virtually
no,
everywhere.
I haven't had the pleasure of doing
That's
that.
Too bad.
It was, and neither the owners, who were twin brothers, yeah. weren't nudists, and they just saw a business opportunity.
Yeah.
They saw an opening. You know, everything has a double entendre when it comes to this story. But there weren't enough customers, or as I think the New York Post said, butts and chairs.
Yeah, that was a good line. Remember, there was this place we used to meet for our show down on Harrison Avenue, that coffee shop that had a gym right next to it.
Oh, sure.
And people would come in there.
It's a great restaurant there now, by the way, the name of which escapes me. But
yeah, well, there used to be a coffee shop.
Yeah, I remember that.
And men would come in from working out, and they'd have their little teeny tiny shirts on. You could see everybody, it's underarm hair and stuff like that. It just doesn't add to the dining pleasure.
Well, you mean Mike's Gym and Gaslight?
Yes, it's Gaslight. That is exactly
where it was next door.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
It's now a Boston sports club.
Okay. Well, there used to be a coffee shop there, and it was disgusting.
See, I would say to Marjorie at that time when she would say that at our meetings, you really don't have to look at their underarm hair. You know, it's there, but it isn't like there's
a mandate to stare at it. Sweating in their gym shorts and little tiny shirts.
So the thing about the French restaurant is it shows what libertines the French are about lots of things, although they're prudes about other things. So you can actually go on museum nights. There are nudist nights in certain Parisian museums.
Yeah, I've read about that.
But now we've seen, and the Times even posted these provocative pictures of people's bare behinds. And, you know, it's stuff you don't necessarily want to look at.
Exactly.
Whereas at least the restaurant confiscated the cell phones. It ushered people into a changing room and it said, you're going to leave your cell phones here. Show us the cell phone. We'll lock them up. So at least the other customers weren't subjected to have their bare behinds appear in the New York Times.
Corby, let me just say, had they allowed people to keep their cell phones, they'd probably still be in business. So that's all I'll say on that.
No, they wouldn't, because it's like when you go to a nude beach and you go visit the nude beach, and the people that should be on the nude beach are not there, and the people that shouldn't be there are there.
Ain't it always the way?
It is always the way. That's why they're generally pretty disappointing.
Corby, it's great to talk to you, as always. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Corby Cummer. Corby Cummer, a food writer, joins us every week. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Up next, how is the government shutdown affecting travel? Boston Globe travel writer Christopher Muther joins us for that and much more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We are live, as we are every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We would be me and Marjorie Egan. I'm Jim Browdy. If you hate cobblestones, let me see, clam chowder, and apocryphal stories about Paul Revere, then Boston is the city for you. Travel writer Christopher Muther from the Boston Globe says the misguided guidebooks usually get Boston wrong. He joins us to talk about this, how you can get travel in 2019 right, and other travel headlines. Christopher Muther is a columnist and travel writer for the Boston Globe. He's also a BPR contributor. Hello, Christopher Muther.
Hello, James. How are you?
I would be excellent. Nice to see you.
Well, likewise.
Before we get to all your great stories, and there are some really great ones here, Christopher Muther, I have a letter here in my hand from
this.
A gentleman named Rich.
I can't believe I gave this to you.
And the subject is, worst interview I've heard in my whole 62 years. And he's writing to Mr. Browdy.
That would be me.
Who interviewed Christopher Muther.
Here's television. What
he says. Dear Mr. Browdy.
Let's make this brief.
Just tried to listen to your interview with the travel writer for the Boston Globe, Christopher Muther, Thursday, January 3rd, 2019. The most disjointed interview I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. Your rudeness, Mr. Browdy, was disgraceful.
Yeah.
Do you even care about people trying to listen at home?
Mm-hmm.
Frustrating waste of time. You acted like a rookie. If you don't like your job and don't care about the people in the audience, why don't you move on to something else? Happy New Year.
I really appreciate it. No, thank you for reading that in its entirety.
Did you notice that this was the worst interview you'd ever endured in your entire life?
Well, I mean, first of all, I have to say to that letter writer, I second that emotion.
Well, I'll just sit this one out.
It was no worse than any of the others.
No worse, okay.
Put it that way.
Disjointed, constant interruptions, talking over you.
I'm used to it.
Yeah, and so am I. I have to say, I'm very used to it by now. So let's talk about the travel, the government shutdown. What's going on at Logan? There are more and more TSA workers calling in sick.
Well, fortunately, Logan hasn't been hit the way a lot of the other airports have. I mean, right now, I think Miami was the first. Atlanta has had it really rough. But in general, about double the number of TSA workers have been calling out sick as they did right about a year ago. And yes, the flu is an issue. I don't think it's as much of an issue as not getting a paycheck.
Yeah.
I think what's also really concerning, and I've been getting a lot of emails about this from industry, travel industry representatives is that the FAA, which sort of has the independent oversight of airline safety, a lot of those people, they're also affected by the shutdown. So 3,600 of them were just called back to work, like in an emergency, because you know these airlines, these airplanes weren't getting inspected to the level that they were previously.
Oh, good.
So you know, people are. What we see are the long lines at airports. What's more concerning to me is the safety of the airplanes that we're flying in.
Did you see? You mentioned Atlanta, Christopher. Did you see that they're now? I don't know who they is, whether it's the airport or the TSA. There is now recommending for a domestic flight, you get there 3 hours.
Yes.
In advance of scheduled takeoff. That's unbelievable.
I mean, you saw those pictures of the lines as well, and I would definitely be there 3 hours, and I'm one of those nervous flyers, like wanting to get there early. So I'd probably be there a day before just to make sure I get through.
Before we move on to some of your other stuff, why has Boston been relatively immune to the TSA sick out?
I feel like, you know, most airports have been, but when you think about Atlanta is a hub, Miami is sort of a huge airport. Dulles has also been affected. These are airports that really are take the brunt of traffic. And Logan isn't up there quite as high. So while there may be slower lines at Logan, we wouldn't see it compounded like these other airports.
We're talking to Christopher Muther, the travel guy from the Boston Globe.
So this is just a wonderful story.
Marjorie was laughing out loud, I should say.
About travel guides, about Boston have it all wrong. If I may take the liberty and read one of your best lines from this story. When you talk about in all the years you've been in Boston, you've never followed around a man wearing a tricorn hat, carrying a musket. You never brought out-of-town guests to the Union Oyster House, and you believed that Faneuil Hall should install a plaque which reads, George Washington didn't shop here, and neither should you. Many great lines in this piece about the cliches about Boston travel guide, but tell us what was your overall point here.
The overall point was I was really tired of hearing these misconceptions and reading these misconceptions about what Boston is as a vacation destination. When I walk through, our offices are downtown, so I walk through downtown on my way to work, and I see groups of people on the Freedom Trail, everybody's taking pictures of the old North Church, and that's great. These are like worthy places, but there's so much more that Boston has to offer, and I feel like that really doesn't come through in a lot of the guides, a lot of, you know, a lot of people now just kind of search the web quickly and see what the top attractions are. And if you search any of them, Freedom Trail is always the first thing. And again, I'm not going to knock the Freedom Trail because it's an important part of U.S. history, but what if you're not interested in history?
Yeah, you know, and it's cold out.
And it's cold out. Or Faneuil Hall is always up there. And when I go to a city, I don't want to go to the main touristy spots. I always want to find something that's different and unique about a city. And, you know, Faneuil Hall may have been different and unique in the 1970s, but right now it's, I don't feel it is. Also, Newbury Street, and I love Newbury Street, but if I want to go shopping at places that I can find in any mall in any city, that's not going to be at the top of my list.
Isn't Charles Street, if you were going to bring somebody that's never been to Boston before to go someplace to look at stores, Charles Street, to me, it's so Boston and it's so different.
Yeah, I mean, I...
So what else did you recommend? What were your alternatives?
I recommended going to around Porter Square. There's like some great little stores around there, like record stores, home decor, secondhand stores. You know, going into Mount Auburn Cemetery.
Oh,
if you want
beautiful
history, go to Mount Auburn Cemetery. You can see a lot of the beauty of the of Boston without hordes of tourists around you.
Yeah, and a lot of famous people over there. The Christian Science.
But they're dead.
Yeah. But you see, like,
so are the people on the Freedom Trail.
Well,
a lot of people find that fascinating to look at the graves of old people. That was a big attraction in Fall River with Lizzie Borden, you know.
Exactly.
Her grave and stuff.
Well, it's also, as I said, Christopher on TV when I wasn't interrupting him, one of the great birding places, we are told,
Mount Auburn
in America is Mount Auburn.
But you know
Auburn
what's
Cemetery
also neat? You have these big mausoleums, and then you have these beautiful ponds.
Exactly,
like in the
right
interior of, it's a very romantic Lover's Lane kind of place over there.
Yeah.
See all sorts of people in the bushes and stuff like that.
Now, let me just, before we leave this topic. I haven't seen that, Marjorie. I mentioned this point when Christopher was on TV with me, which I assume is why he wrote that angry letter under an assumed name criticizing me.
Because that was my mom wrote it, actually.
I pointed out that he was listing some of the most famous attractions in Boston, saying there's suitable alternatives. Is that not correct, what you did there? Okay.
That's correct,
that's
yes.
correct. Now, Marjorie, other than Faneuil Hall, yep. which he had on that list, and the Freedom Trail, what is always in the top three attractions for tourists in Boston that Christopher omitted from his list of places to bypass? Why are you making a face?
I'm like an investigative reporter.
What would that be?
I don't know. I'm getting Fenway Park.
Oh, and who owns Fenway Park?
Oh, my goodness. The guy that owns the Boston Globe.
Come clean, will you please?
Oh, my goodness. That's
he's like
good,
red
yeah.
as a beet now.
I took a shower before I came here. I am clean, I promise.
Okay, here is another brilliant idea, if I do say. So. I'm going to be a lot of flattery too. Here today for you, Christopher Mueller, because these are really clever.
Keep it coming.
Everybody does, it's true, everybody goes to the same places over and over again. And you have a whole piece about where to go to avoid some of the crowds, places I mostly never heard of. So tell people, instead of Paris, where should you go?
Bordeaux. I love absolutely love Bordeaux. I had never been there, and I went last summer, and I thought, how is it that I've never been here? And two, why aren't there more people here? Because it has so many of the attributes that Paris has, the architecture, the food. It has this beautiful river, which it's not the Seine, but still, it's absolutely lovely. And I feel like, Paris, a lot of people go, you've been, it's your bucket list place. But where do you go after Paris? Do you keep going back? And I just wanted to say, Marjorie, the inspiration behind this story was that there's so much over-tourism happening in specific places. In Barcelona, they're protesting the number of tourists who are coming in. Venice is just drowning in tourists and water. So
that's right. You better go there fast, though.
Exactly.
That's actually
longer.
True, sadly. That yeah. really is.
So I really wanted to give people alternatives, one, for their own their own help, but also to sort of aid these cities and sort of steering people elsewhere and to all sorts of great places that they may not think to go to.
I'm not going to pronounce this right. Machu Picchu?
Yeah, you did.
You got it.
I did,
yeah.
Okay. That's the place people go climbing. Tell people about that.
It's the ancient site that was only discovered at the turn of the last century, but the beautiful, right, it's steeped in the hills. It's one of the, I'm trying to think which wonder of the world or if it falls into the main wonder of the world, but it's a very unique place, and it's also very dependent on ecology and nature. And if those things are trampled.
Yeah, it's overrun.
By, thousands and thousands of people going there every day. But again, it's a bucket list place that people want to see.
Yeah, and instead of going to Reykjavik in Iceland, where should you go?
I suggested Bergen, Norway.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful, and it's a good jumping-off point for nature-y things to do. You can see the Northern Lights in Norway. You can do a lot of the same things you can in Iceland.
I'm not like a world traveler like Jim, who goes every place.
Oh,
he's
please,
always,
you
he's
are
always
a world
having a little espresso.
I'm having
the
international
Champs-Élysées.
Experiences. I have
but
had
I,
quite a few.
I remember being really disappointed when I went to Florence because it was overrun. But it's overrun. It's really, really crowded. And that's sort of depressing. You go on vacation. What's the bridge? Arno, I think, is the bridge there that crosses the river. And it's just loaded with people. And there are all these other beautiful places.
Did you read his thing, though? He says instead of Florence, try Everett. He did.
Woburn. Woburn's the hot new destination.
Oh, you did write that Woburn was a hot destination. Didn't you write a couple
last
months
year,
ago?
Yes. Exactly. And I wasn't comparing it to Florence. Actually, Woburn is the Florence of Massachusetts.
That's right.
We all knew that.
That's right. I went to, Sicily. I went to Sicily.
Excuse me.
Not very crowded down in Sicily.
Can we move on to the story that is most something to me. I don't know what the adjective is. Frontier Airlines is coming to Boston, and I say, so what? I mean, the good news is
you're not going to fit in the plane,
I'm reading
Jim,
the story.
Don't worry.
Exactly. It's one of the cheapest airlines, which is great. What's not so great is it's one of the worst airlines, one of the least comfortable airlines.
True.
Has the smallest seats. You pay for absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the net gain by Frontier coming to Boston, to Logan? Is there one?
I mean, for them, there's a net gain.
No, I understand that. But I'm serious. This is about as bad as an airline. I don't mean unsafe, because I don't think that's an issue. But in terms of their how they take care of the customer, I think 11th out of 12, correct?
Yes.
And what's the seat situation, the space deal?
I think it's 18 inches width. I think the pitch is 29, which is, I think, in your case, that means your knees would be at your ears.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tight, the seats don't recline, which is good. You don't have to worry about someone reclining into your non-existent space. But, you know, the thing of Frontier is it's, like all the other low-cost airlines, which are actually just taking off right now, no pun intended, to the point where the majors had to start offering basic economy to fight fight with the low fares of Spirit and Norwegian. And
you know what you should write if you haven't written already or hasn't been written already? Not only are these low-cost airlines, for the most part, totally uncomfortable and uncivil, I would argue, to the customer, but I would bet in many situations they're not as cheap comparatively as people think. Because when you pile up all the baggage fees and the seat that you can actually fit in fees and the whatever, my assumption is the prices become much more comparable with, like, I don't mean to advance JetBlue, but JetBlue is actually a pretty comfortable seat.
Yes.
To be in, you're treated almost like a human being.
I'll advance JetBlue.
No,
I'm
serious.
Them. Yeah,
but isn't that a fair?
It's fair. It's true. I think I did something a few years ago on it, but it's always
worth
revisiting.
Well, I think I'd do it again. And what I also read, did you write is the Frontier piece your piece or is it not your
it's
piece?
It's my piece.
Okay. Do you also mention, which
Rich is
going to
send another letter, Jim,
well,
I think.
Well, it's okay. Yeah. Yes, mother. So, which I've never read before. They allow tipping on Frontier Airlines?
Yes.
Tipping on an airplane?
This is the first time I'd ever heard of flight attendants getting tipped.
Oh,
so
great.
The policy's been in place for 3 years. However, within that period, it was always the flight attendants would pool their tips. And now the tipping is, you know, every man or woman for themselves. So that always makes me think, well, what would happen in an emergency if I, you know, stiffed my flight attendant on a tip? And I'm rushing to get out. Would she sort of hold me back so others who tipped higher could get out of the plane first? I mean, this is a complete silly conjecture. I'm not saying this would happen at all, but this is how my mind works.
Yeah, no, me too.
But I don't know. Can we stay on this for 1 second? Because I hadn't heard of it before. Is the notion that you are encouraged to tip a flight attendant for an individual act, like giving you a drink, or you tip a flight attendant on the way out because he or she has been, no, I mean, treated you.
They stand with a bucket like Broadway Cares at the end of the show.
So what is the expectation? How does it work?
Well, if you know, as you pointed out before, you pay for everything on these flights. So let's say I order a tab, not that they sell tab, or let's just say Diet Coke to be a little modern. And they come around with the tablet and I sign.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So on there, I have the option of tipping.
Boy, that is really unbelievable. By the way, we're getting some email from people saying we didn't say enough of what your alternatives were. Instead of Wellfleet, go to Groton, Connecticut. I really didn't mean that.
Groton, Connecticut.
Instead of Santorini, try Navos in Greece.
Naxos.
Naxos. I've gotten both of them wrong. Let me see if I can get this one. Instead of Venice, try, how do you say Tigre?
Tigre
of Buenos Aires. That's the end of that thing.
Okay, I never.
When is Frontier coming? By the way, before Margaret.
March.
Okay.
I never heard of this city in Mexico.
Nor had I.
San Miguel de Allende.
De Allende.
Thank you. My Spanish is not what it should be. Travel and Leisure says this is the best city in the world.
Like 2 or 3 years in a row.
What's going on?
That's what I wanted to know. So I hopped in a plane. I went down there. And it's a pretty charming little place. Again, I'd never heard of it, but there's a huge expat community. Lots and lots of Americans there who have retired there because cost of living is low. It's beautiful. There's all this great Spanish colonial architecture. There's this amazing sort of pink cathedral in the middle of the city. Gorgeous sunsets.
Wow.
All sorts of things. Yeah.
Do they get free health care, all these expats from America in Mexico?
I don't think they get free health care.
Are they mad at us for calling everybody a rapist and a criminal?
We don't do that. Our president does.
He would never do that.
Is it the best city in the world?
No, it's
not. What is it? Is it worth going to?
Oh, it's totally worth going to. I mean, from Boston, it's a little bit of a hike because you have to get to Mexico City. And then from Mexico City, there's another flight. And then from there, it's another hour and a half drive. If you fly to, like, Houston or San Diego, there are direct flights. But it's, I mean, it's not the best city in the world, but I would rank it very, very high in terms of the comfort of it and the beauty of it.
You know,
what
I don't
is
know if
the best city in the world,
go
do
ahead.
You think?
Bum, bum, bum.
What is it?
You know, does... What's my favorite
yeah,
city?
Yeah,
in the
I was going to ask
yeah.
you the same question. We've never asked you that. What is your favorite place to visit?
I'd have to say Boston.
No,
like I love
there you
I
go.
Love the Freedom Trail
and Fenway Park and
Cobblestone.
Hall.
No, seriously, what is your favorite place? Or what are some of your favorite places that are affordable too? Let's have them affordable and favorite.
Oh, geez. Well, those don't really overlap for me.
Okay.
But some of my favorite cities are Santiago, Chile.
Why?
It's sort of like an interesting crossroads right now where it's developing, but it still has some of its rustic characteristics. I really love Buenos Aires, which is kind of inexpensive right now, thanks to the economy.
What's
there.
Your favorite American city?
Oh, Montreal. Let me just throw in Montreal. It's
probably
my favorite city.
That was
really?
Great. I was
yes.
Last
of them all?
2 weeks ago.
Of them all.
God, I gotta go there.
This week.
Why is it? Why do you feel that way?
I love the culture there. I love the people there. I've just had so many wonderful experiences. I've been going there for so long, long before I was writing about travel. So it's sentimental
How
as well.
How expensive is it?
It's not very expensive because
oh,
the Canadian dollar is weak
yeah,
against
right
the U.S.
dollar.
Really
is. You ever been to Schwartz's Deli?
I have been to Schwartz's Deli.
How great is Schwartz's? One of the best
smoked meat sandwiches.
Oh, my God. Well, forget sandwiches. I think I said this in the other day. I went there. My Uber driver suggested I actually go there, and I went there, and I had forgotten about it. Because the line was so long, which I'm told it always is, no matter how cold it is,
yes.
you can get takeout. And if you get takeout, you can buy for $14, which is unreal, hand-cut pound of corned beef. It's almost worth driving to Montreal for this. You buy a loaf of bread, you buy a container of mustard, and you go back to your room and you do the thing there. I mean, it's or not that thing, but the other thing. Why are you making a face? It doesn't get any better than
no,
that.
No, it's just a pound of corned beef. It's a lot of corned beef.
Well, you don't have to eat the whole thing. I'm just saying you get it for $14.
You do the thing in your room for the corned beef.
I didn't mean that. So before you go.
Let your friends out.
Yeah, exactly.
What is the Boston Globe Travel Show, and do you have anything to do with it? It's coming up, is it not?
It is. It's coming up January 18th to the 20th. It happens at the Seaport World Trade Center. And I do have something to do
with
it.
What do you do?
I walk around and I stare at people and I sell subscriptions to the Globe. No, this year I'm going to be interviewing the host of Hotel Impossible, which is on the Travel Channel. So that's kind of my involvement this year. But there's so many other great things.
Like what?
There's a craft beer pavilion.
Oh,
so if you're not
fun.
Interested in travel, you can go get drunk. I mean, you can go sample craft beer.
What if you are interested in travel? What do you get out of this thing? I don't think I've ever been. What is
really?
There?
No,
I, don't
no,
think
I
so.
Didn't even know about it.
What else is
what?
There?
So one of the great things for me about it is walking around and seeing the different vendors because different countries, cities, hotels, cruise lines are
great.
There. So you can kind of get information and get a feel for places. There's also... like they'll have cultural presentations, food presentations, there's giveaways. It's a fun time. I actually enjoy it.
Actually sounds great. When is it again?
Happens January 18th to the 20th, so it's this weekend.
Is there a website or something, or you have no idea?
BostonGlobe.com.
Oh.
You've heard of that.
Where you can find all of my wonderful stories
exactly.
that we've been talking
we
about.
We didn't get to one of your stories about Miami, but next time we'll do that. The other side, away from the ocean in Miami. That was a great piece, too. Anyway, Christopher, thank
nice
you very
you,
much.
Christopher Muther.
Thank you both.
Christopher Muther is a travel writer
he
and
is.
Columnist for the Boston Globe and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Great to have you in here, Christopher. Coming up, CNN's John King is here to go over the latest headlines coming out of D.C., including the hearings that are going on now for the possible new attorney general. We'll hear how Attorney Barr is doing before the senators. John King is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, here broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Join us online to go over the latest political headlines, which includes the ongoing hearing of William Barr, who's been nominated by the president to be his attorney general, is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, of course, is the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon or Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Hello there, John King.
Happy Tuesday from a still partially shut down snowy Washington.
Indeed.
Yeah, we still have the snow when the president was out there. We don't have any snow at all here. But anyway, John, you know, I've been sneaking glances at CNN while we've been on the air today, and it sounds like William Barr, the nominee for attorney general, is saying the things that many people, especially Democrats, would want to hear, that they're not going to let the president correct Mueller's report, that it's really important that he finish it, and Mueller, that is, and that the report is public, et cetera. How's he doing?
Oh, he's going to be the next attorney general of the United States. I mean,
yeah.
The Republicans have majority anyway. My big question is, do some of the Democrats vote for him? The only guy who might be unhappy is the president of the United States with his own pick for attorney general, in the sense that he says he thinks Jeff Sessions made the right decision to recuse himself. He will not allow any political influence on the Mueller investigation. He views Bob Mueller as a friend. He thinks Bob Mueller is a man of great judgment. He thinks it's important for the country and for the president for Bob Mueller to finish his work unimpeded. The one sticking point has been he says he wants to make as much of it as possible public, consistent with the Mueller report, assuming Mueller files a report with the Justice Department. There's some Democrats are a little skeptical when he says, you know, I will make as much of it public, consistent with the law and the regulations. You can read that as he's going to make as much of it public as he can, or you can read that as he's going to try to find something, you know, a semicolon to hide behind to keep some of it secret. Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota, pressed him, what about the conclusions? Will you at least make all the conclusions public, even if there's some national security, you know, sensitive classified information that prevents you from putting some of the evidence behind them? And he said he saw no reason why he wouldn't. So if, look, this, any Democratic objections to anything he said so far are because Donald Trump appointed him, not because of anything Mr. Barr has said.
Are the Democrats, are some Democrats, more than one or two, going to vote for this guy, John, in your estimation?
I think they would like to, Jim. The pressure when Patrick Leahy and Dianne Feinstein, two of the older Democrats on the committee, the more senior Democrats on the committee, who know Mr. Barr. Mr. Barr, remember, he was Attorney General for 4 years in the George H.W. Bush administration. He was in other Justice Department jobs before that. He worked at the CIA. He was in the Reagan administration. And he's been a corporate lawyer, including for my company, Time Warner, now AT&T, but Time Warner, who was part of the merger there. He's been around this town for 30-plus years. He is very well-known. He is very well-liked. He is incredibly well-respected. Now, the Democrats disagree with him on a lot of issues, but most of them actually privately would tell you they're so happy the president found an adult, an experienced guy who knows the law, who understands the importance of the Justice Department and its independence. The Democrats, frankly, are shocked that the president nominated somebody of this caliber, which is why they've been asking Barr, essentially, you know, have you had a brain transplant or are you not the person we used to know? Will they vote for him, Jim? I think he's going to get some Democratic votes. I really do. He was confirmed 100-0.
Right.
27 years ago. Now, that's not going to happen. We don't live in that world anymore. Some Democrats are going to vote no because he's a Trump appointee and they feel they have to vote no. But he has done zip. He's done zip so far to give you any policy position or Mueller-related answer to get you to vote no. He hasn't done that.
Well, two things I've read about him over and over is that he is a guy, as you said, with a great reputation, John, so he's not going to let, in the later part of his career, his reputation be sullied by some sort of shenanigans with the president and the Mueller report. But then again, it was, how long was it, 16 pages, 19 pages, this long memo that he wrote as a private citizen criticizing Mueller, that seems a lot.
Or criticizing the investigation,
yes.
Not Mueller as such, correct?
Yeah, and he's answered a lot of questions about that, and he's going to face more. Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut is coming at him now. We've yet to hear from the 2020 Democrats, as I call them. Klobuchar was one of them, but Kamala Harris and Cory Booker still to come. So you can be sure the Democrats are going to push him. And the memo does raise a lot of questions. Even some of the Republicans asked him about that memo. What Barr said was, look, there's a bunch of us around town, and this is true, a bunch of us around town, Democrats and Republicans, who served in senior positions, who play Monday morning quarterback. When we see a big issue in the news, when we see a big issue in the newspapers or on TV, or we hear about a big issue in his case in the legal system, if something alarms them or excites them or just piques their interest, they write these memos and they swap them around town, sort of, hey, you know, maybe you don't want my opinion, but I used to have your job here. Take a look at this. And he says he sent it to Rod Rosenstein and then sent it around to a broader group of lawyers. The point he made was, he said he thinks that people are overplaying the criticism of Mueller. He said that it, he said based on his, he said number one, he said, I know no facts. I have no inside information. Based on his reading of news accounts, he thought Mueller was perhaps pursuing what Bill Barr believes is a novel obstruction of justice line. And what he essentially said was there are other obstruction of justice statutes that if the president's hiding evidence, destroying evidence, telling people to lie, then the president can be prosecuted. He made that very clear in his testimony. He also told the Democrats, you know, I sent one of these in another case saying that the Justice Department should not prosecute Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat. So what he's essentially saying is we do this. There's a bunch of us around town, and we do this because we, you know, we're comfortable corporate lawyers, and we just like to be involved in these conversations.
Okay.
John,
so we'll see how it goes. Democrats have some legitimate questions about it, but he had a pretty good answer.
One last related question before we move on, John. I assume that the follow-up to that questions about his memo were recusal questions, and I saw on your screen, while you were on the air, that he said that Sessions probably made the right decision to recuse himself. Was he asked about either Whitaker's decision, the acting attorney general, on recusal, and whether he would consider recusing himself because of the memo?
He just said moments ago, and again, remember, he says, I don't know all the facts yet, so I have to get briefed on the facts once I'm confirmed. He said that he sees no reason he should have to recuse himself as of now. That he thinks, you know, that this is his job, and that the attorney, you know, he said that if Mueller makes a case for resources, he'll give him the resources. He says he sees no scenario under which Mueller could ever be fired. He said that if the president told him fire him anyway, he would refuse to do that. Right now he's making a case that he has the independence and the integrity to oversee Mueller, and he says if he learns anything new and a red flag goes off, he'll raise his hand.
We're talking to
John. He was asked about Whitaker. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. What did he say about Whitaker?
He was asked about Whitaker, and he said he doesn't know all the facts because he's not there to see the back and forth. And he said that, you know, they did say that, you know, out of the recommendation was out of an abundance of caution from the ethics officers that he should recuse himself, and Whitaker refused that, declined. He tried to shrug it off by saying, you know, out of an abundance of caution leads me to believe that it was a close call, that it was a coin toss. And, you know, he said, then he went on to say, I don't know enough about it. It's also crystal clear, though, that Whitaker's not staying. If Barr gets confirmed, Whitaker's leaving the Justice Department. So part of his strategy is to, like, that's somebody else's problem. That's not my problem.
So, John King, we're approaching 4 weeks of a partial government shutdown. We, like you, have talked a lot with our listeners and actually some listeners who are contract employees and either furloughed employees or employees who were federal employees who were forced to go to work unpaid, about the unconscionable nature of this and the cruelty to the individuals involved. Is there any indication that someone's got a plan here? We know Lindsey Graham came up with his open it up and let's give it 3 weeks, then declare your national emergency, which the president rejected. Is anybody have a roadmap to get the government and these 800,000 employees out of this mess?
Nope.
So what does that mean?
I mean, there are a lot of conversations. I don't know what it means. Isn't that stunning that there's nobody who can tell you how the government's going to reopen? I mean, look, there's an easy roadmap. You got a deal. The president has to accept, you know, $2 billion or $1.7 billion or $2 billion, or maybe he can leverage him up to $2.5 billion, not the $6 billion he wants, and you do some other border security stuff, and then he has to give the Democrats something in exchange for that border wall funding. We've seen these for years in a traditional common sense count the votes, cut the best deal. But there's none of that going on right now. Now there are groups on Capitol Hill talking about that, that should there be an opening, should Nancy Pelosi or the president raise their hand and say, I'm prepared to blink, this will be, if the president's right, the one thing he's been dead right about is it'll take about 15 minutes, maybe 45 tops, to cut a deal once there's a willingness to deal. But the president, I don't get this, he could have gotten more money when his own party controlled the House. Once the Democrats took power in the House and fundamentally changed the balance of power here in Washington, he started asking for more, when normally you would ask for less because you just lost leverage. He asked for more. And the other part of this is, you know, the polling shows the public blames the president. It's the president's border wall demand that is the source of the impasse here. But The other factor here is that Nancy Pelosi is the new House Speaker. She got to be Speaker by calming down and overcoming opposition from some of the more progressive members in her conference. And there is just no way in you know what that her first deal out of the box is going to be to give Donald Trump his border wall.
You know, John, I've asked this question.
Can they be forced to do something? I think that's still the open question. But right now, her answer is no. Nothing. And so here we are.
Well, I started saying I'm going to ask the same question I've asked somebody, but you have bring more to the table than many of us. So I'll try to ask it for the last time today. Has Nancy Pelosi or has Chuck Schumer been asked why, how they can say that a year ago they were okay on $25 billion for the wall in return for protection for the so-called Dreamers? And now their position is not a nickel for the wall. The people we've asked have had two answers. One, because the new progressive members on the Democratic side wouldn't allow her to offer a nickel or close to a nickel. And the other side is that there's no point in doing it because Ann Coulter et al., the generic Ann Coulter, would never allow Donald Trump to cut any deal, even if he got $5 billion for the Dreamers. What's your analysis of where this is on that front?
See, all of the above. Okay. Plus, Nancy Pelosi does have limited maneuverability because of her fractious caucus and questions about. This is her first big showdown with the President of the United States. This is a big deal. And it's about the wall. It's about the shutdown. But it's also about the next 2 years. It's not just about, you know, I know it's painful for federal workers and they're listening to some clown from Washington trying to explain why they're not getting a paycheck. I'm not trying to justify why you're not getting a paycheck. I'm trying to explain the dynamics going on here. But, you know, and part of it is the Democrats, A, they're very skeptical that the President, that's why they don't listen to Mike Pence and they don't listen to Jared Kushner. There are days when I'll criticize Mike Pence and Jared Kushner, but these guys are going up there and saying, well, what if we did this? And they're like, listen, you don't have the President, you told us the President would sign a bill with no border wall funding. You know, get out of the room. This has to come directly from the President, and he has to say it publicly, and he has to tweet it, or else we're not going to believe it. The other part is the Democrats' part. To the point of why they would do that a year ago and not now, the House Democrats' answer is we were in the minority. That was the best deal we could get when we were in the minority. We're in the majority now. We deserve a better deal. Nancy Pelosi has said, why would I give you the wall, which polls at about 35% support, maybe 40% if you look at some polls, in exchange for DACA, which 85% of the American people say, don't blame the Dreamers, give them status. So what she says is that's not an even trade. If you involve me in those conversations, you got to bring me more. Now that I'm in the majority, I don't have to take that deal, and I won't take that deal.
We're talking to John King from CNN.
So John King, the Congressman Stephen King from Iowa, who said a lot of racist things in his past, anti-Muslim and so forth, and just questioned why white supremacy is considered offensive. He's been stripped of his committee assignments by the Republicans. Mitt Romney said he should quit. Liz Cheney, the third-ranking Republican from Wyoming out there, she said he should quit. McConnell said he should find another line of work. Trump has said nothing. Is this the end of this or what?
Look, there's already a primary challenger announced to Congressman King back home. I think the Republicans are going to spend money against him if he stays on the ballot. He's been stripped of any reason to be in Congress, which is to be in a committee to try to have some influence. Let me help him with the answer. White supremacy is reprehensible and heinous and horrible, and we have a problem in our divided country right now, and leaders should speak up more clearly. He has a history of this stuff. A lot of people are saying, why did it take so long for the Republicans to come around and recognize this? That's a fair debate. My point, though, is to say, amen, we're at this moment where they apparently learned a lesson from the 2018 elections, or the straw has broken the camel's back, to borrow the cliche, and they just can't take this anymore. The fact that the Republicans from his own state or telling him sit down and shut up, and some of them, and they clearly would like him to go, is a good thing. Here's one of the issues for the Republicans now. They've stripped him of his committee assignment. The Democrats are going to move ahead with different versions of censure and punishment in the House. There is a follow-up question to this. Is now what Steve King has said is off the charts, but if you're going to start censuring people and calling out publicly, and the Republican Party wants to get to a better place on the question of tolerance, okay, now you've done this to the congressman from Iowa. What about all those things said by the President of the United States?
Well, you know, it's funny
about
you say
Charlottesville and about other.
You know, you said amen a couple of seconds ago, John, which is exactly what I said to one of our coworkers this morning, who in turn said to me more politely than this, but I think it's what she was saying, you're naive, Jim. The reason the Republicans decided to finally act on Steve King, because he's been doing things like this, even if this is the most egregious, for quite a while, is they don't want to do anything to the guy who referred to Senator Warren yet again as Pocahontas in a tweet the other night, mentioning Little Bighorn and
Wounded Knee,
which he obviously knows absolutely nothing about, and that it's purely a CYA kind of thing, so they can say they acted and distract people away from their inaction vis-a-vis the president. Do you subscribe to that, or what do you think?
I think that's a perfectly rational argument for somebody to make. The question is, if the Republicans go forward with this on Steve King, is there any follow-up? Is there any, at least a conversation? It's hard. He's the president of the United States. He is who he is. He's the leader of their party. A lot of Republicans privately say things about this president and the way he conducts his business and the things he says about women and about race and about all sorts of questions of tolerance, just respect. Tolerance mm-hmm. for anybody is born of respect for the fellow human being, whatever they look like, whatever they worship, whatever they believe, whoever they love. Wherever they come from, and they say this president just doesn't have that. That's what they say privately. Some have gone there publicly. Senator Romney took some heat when he said it before he was even sworn in. I don't think we're at this, page-turning moment when it comes to the president, but we are at a new moment for the Republican Party, for a lot of people in the Republican Party anyway, after an election where they have been biting their tongue for a long time. I'm not excusing that, who are now saying, look, the American people, look what's happening to us in the suburbs. Look what's happening to us across America. Look what's happening with people of color. Look what's happening to us with millennials. Wake up. Stop hiding. So if they do this to Steve King, number one, he's earned it. And then I do think it's a fair question. Are we going to go back and relitigate everything the president's going to say, or are they at least going to have a new standard as we go forward into a campaign where Senator Warren, and you have a number of African Americans going to be out there running for president as well, a number of Latinos out there as well. Will they at least start a day one on the clock for President Trump? I think that's a fair question too. But just censuring Steve King is not going to end the debate. Is there some CYA to it? Of course there is. Is there some politics to it? Of course there is. I'm much, in a town where there are motives for everything, that they're doing it is a good thing and an overdue thing, and then I think we should go from there.
Okay, you have 15 seconds. What's the score Sunday night?
Oh, man, it's going to be cold, so I'm going to say 28-24. Good guys.
There's the
I'm looking for the Father Time Super Bowl. Brady and Breeze. It's going to be the Father Time Super Bowl. There we go.
Father Time Super Bowl.
Good to talk
to you,
John King.
Thank you very, very much. John King joins us every week. He's seen as Chief National Correspondent and the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon. Jim and I are watching it, even though we're on the air. And Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Coming up, transplant surgeon Joshua Mesrick is here to talk about his new book, When Death Becomes Life. Joshua Mesrick next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Public Radio, I'm Jim Browdy, she's Marjorie, and we are live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. In his new book, transplant surgeon Joshua Mesrick takes us into the operating room with his experiences of giving patients a second chance. And along the way, he connects the medical breakthroughs of today to the history of transplant surgery. It's called When Death Becomes Life, Notes from a Transplant Surgeon. You can catch him tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 o'clock. Joshua Mesrick is an assistant professor of surgery at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Very good to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you sure do take us into the operating room, right down where you draw on the things on the people's bellies and making the cut and all that kind of stuff. But before we get to the whole picture of transplants and what you do and where we are in transplants, there's a very interesting concept, which I haven't thought of, that you talk about, is what is being dead? Explain what you mean in terms of transplant. What is it for a human being to die?
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic, and actually transplant played a very central role in trying to define what death is. Before people were thinking about taking organs out to do transplants, maybe people didn't have to think that much about what might define legally dead. And in the early days of transplant, it still was a little bit unclear. But once we started doing heart transplants in the late 60s, it became clear that we needed to find a way to define when people are truly dead. Maybe the biggest paper on this topic was written in 1968 in JAMA, and one of the lead authors was actually a transplant surgeon, and they defined brain death as legally dead. It took about 10 or 12 years for that to be really accepted and then ultimately to become law. And actually a bunch of transplant surgeons were accused of murder, and even a few stood trial for different aspects of that.
There's a difference between brain dead and, was it circulatory dead?
That's right.
What's the difference?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing, and one thing that I think is interesting is it's possible that not everyone would agree on the definition. So there's a brain death, which is legally dead, which means there's no blood flow to your brain, and there are very specific ways to diagnose that. But your heart is still beating when you're brain dead, and there are people out there who might think, I think death is when the heart stops beating, and that was the traditional definition of death. You know, a challenge for transplant is it's better if we can take the organs out while the heart is still beating, so you can see the inherent conflict there. Circulatory death is dead, so that means your heart's not beating, you have no blood flow, you have no oxygen, so that is clearly dead.
Okay.
So there are a couple of stories that I just loved here, and I'm about to get to one. Before I do, most of us first heard of transplant surgery when the heart stuff happened. I guess, was that in the late 60s or thereabouts? When did it actually start? It started, obviously, pre the Bernards and the others of the world. When did it first start?
You mean
transplants in general? When did we first see these things?
Well, I mean, I think about the modern history of transplant, which really started in 1954, with a transplant of a kidney between identical twins. But then you can back up right around the turn of the century, 1890s into 1900, Alexis Carrel started doing transplants between animals where he would do kidneys, limb transplants, thyroid transplants. Actually, there are medieval and even before that examples of transplant. There's a famous painting where a person has one black leg and one white leg. So I think the concept of tissue transplant and transplantation has been around for a long time.
You know, one of the couple of stories that I like the most, you're a great storyteller in addition, I assume you're a pretty good surgeon, by the way, let's hope you are, is talk about your first experience with this, which I really, really loved.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in many ways I kind of stumbled into becoming a doctor. My dad did go back to medical school when I was in third grade, and I thought his stories were great, and they used to totally gross out my brother Ben, who's here today. But I was fascinated by that. But I have to say, in many ways, I feel like I stumbled into the field of medicine. But my first day on the surgical rotation, I walked in, and of course, that day found out I was on call, which is the way it always seems to work. I'd been working all day. I was exhausted. And then around midnight, I was sent into a room to scrub on an operation, and I didn't know what it was going to be. I came in and the classical music was playing and this older surgeon was doing the surgery. It was very calm and it was a kidney transplant and we were sewing it in. I was really just watching and cutting sutures and they were always telling me they were too long or this kind of thing. And when he released the clamps and the kidney turned pink and urine started flowing out onto her hands, I sat there thinking, I can't believe we can do this. This is so great. And what wasn't lost on me was that someone had just died, and this organ had been working in that person and was now really saving the life of this person. And I was just taken by that. And I thought, you know, could I do this?
You know, you mentioned your brother, just as an aside. What is it with the family authors that there's no title that is fewer than like 50 words? When your brother was here, I don't know, 6 months ago, we asked him without looking at a piece of paper to actually recite verbatim the title of any of his books, and he couldn't do it. So is there like a genetic thing in the family or what is it? Obviously nervous laughter. Let's move on then if that's the case. But
you talk about too going out and I guess we don't say harvest organs anymore, procure the organs, right, that you've actually done that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was interesting to me is as I've talked to my friends who I grew up with, they're really surprised by kind of the things that we actually do in our job. And so I wanted to write a really clear book about what really happens. One of the interesting things about transplant is we have the donors and we have to get their organs. And removing the organs is actually a pretty complex operation. It's not just like throw everything in the cooler. You have to do it very carefully. It's a true operation, and if it's not done well, it'll affect the organ quality. So we do go out, and it's almost always at night, and it's in these little planes, and sometimes the weather's not good. It's sort of exciting. It's sort of an adventurous part of the job. In many ways, it's one of the most important parts of the job because the donors are so special, and the donor families who are going through this terrible tragedy truly hang on to every word. They love talking to us. They don't want us to leave. It's very, very special. But the actual details of going out can be kind of crazy. And so I purposely started and ended the book with some flights on our small planes.
Yeah, because you get the notice that there's someone there, and then you've got to go. And different organs do differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Each organ is its own deal, and different teams go for them. So usually there's a heart team and a lung team and then the abdominal team. I'm an abdominal transplant surgeon, so that's what I focus on.
We're talking to Dr. Joshua Mesrick. His book is When Death Becomes Life, Notes from a Transplant Surgeon. That's a perfect segue to my favorite story in the whole book. I always wonder, whenever there's a photo, which I assume moves you too, when a relative of the donor gets to meet the man or woman who's the lucky recipient, and you see the bond between these, it's like so powerful. Even secondhand, it's unbelievable. But the thing I always wondered about is if you get somebody's organ, does part of that person become you? And you tell a hamburger story that answers the question for me that I love. Could you tell that for us,
yeah,
please?
I mean, this is one of my favorite chapters in the book. And there are numerous stories like this in the transplant world, but there's this young girl, Michaela, who was a totally healthy girl from a small town in Wisconsin. I write in there that it's 98% white and 100% Packer fans. And she was totally healthy and then suddenly developed acute liver failure. She had this rare disease called Wilson's disease, and she almost died. She ends up receiving the liver from an African-American gentleman from Rockford, much different type of city outside of in Illinois, outside Chicago. And the surgery goes great, and she gets better immediately. But one of the things that she notices when she wakes up is she's just dying for a hamburger. And that is really strange because she barely eats any meat. Her family was really shocked by this, and they got her a hamburger. She was dying to meet the family of the donor, these people who really saved her life. And she wrote all these letters. And they kept not responding. And then finally, they responded. And actually, the organ procurement organization had let the mother know that the letter was coming. So she quickly turned her phone on when Michaela answered the mail, and I was able to see this video, but her hands are shaking, and she's crying, and she opens the letter, and she goes, "Oh, my God, he loves hamburgers."
Oh, wow.
That is great.
So what's the explanation for that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of stories like this in transplant where people take on characteristics, certain likes, certain dislikes that seem to fit with the donor. You never know if it's real or biologic, and I don't want to give some scientific explanation that makes it less cool.
So there's two questions I had about livers. And number one, we mentioned before we have Art Kaplan, a medical ethicist, who comes on with us all the time. And he was talking about, I don't know if it was just about livers, but the idea of people getting organs from people who are drug addicted. Mm-hmm. And he said it's become more common because you can treat the drug addiction. Where are, because there's a lot of, tragically, young people dying from opioids.
Yeah, I mean, this is an important topic that most people don't realize. I don't want to call it a silver lining because we are going through this incredible crisis with drug addiction, but actually so many of those donors, sadly, are young and they become brain dead from an overdose. And in fact, transplant volumes went up 10 to 20% over each of the last 2 years because of the opioid crisis.
Wow.
This is obviously not something we want, but I guess at least it is leading to some lives saved and something positive for the donor families.
And the other thing I was going to ask you, I see these ads all the time. I see them on CNN, I'm sure they're elsewhere, where they talk about people that are waiting for livers. And they say, you can get out of the line and you can do this and get a liver. And I thought, can that really be true?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
You watch House of Cards? Kevin Spacey's character, the President of the United States, jumped the line, essentially, to get a transplant. Does that happen?
There have been other stories like that. And Steve Jobs, of course, got a liver transplant. Yeah. So, yes, you can do living donor liver transplant. We do way more kidneys, which is a little bit less complex, but livers can be done. It is a big operation on the donor, and although they tend to survive, it's certainly a big operation. We do something like 100 deceased donor liver transplants a year and 10 living donors at my program. and maybe something like 250, 300 living donors in this country. There are other countries in Asia, for instance, where they do hundreds of living donor livers. So that's the case. Now, can people jump the line? So I think the livers are given out based on how sick you are, how sick your liver is, and that you can't really change. But what people with means can do is look for programs where the wait list is more favorable. So, you know, like in
health. And fly there and go live there?
Yeah, I mean, you can be listed in multiple centers as long as your insurance company will approve that. So, obviously, if you're Steve Jobs, your insurance company will probably be okay.
And the other thing is the alcoholism issue, because many people have liver problems because they've been drinking too much. What is the thinking now in 2019 about transplants for people who are alcoholics?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big part of our business, and it usually is a great success. But, you know, alcoholism really is a disease, and it's a disease that's difficult to treat and that does recur. I don't think we do a good enough job at treating the disease, but we try really hard to identify patients that have insight and that are really going to try and take care of their organs after and not go back to drinking. We're like 80% successful. You know, it's hard, though, when you have someone in front of you often who's young and you have this treatment that can save them, and then you have to decide, am I going to do it for you? And so we work hard with a big team to figure out, do they get it? Are they going to really put effort into this?
But how about talking about difficult decisions? We also discussed with Art Kaplan is the financial considerations about your ability to afford the after treatment and the drugs and all this kind of crap. Where are we as compared to the rest of the world with that being a criterion for selection?
Well, I mean, it's a huge challenge. We do a lot of transplants in this country, but you have to have insurance to get a transplant. There is this bizarre thing, which if you're for kidneys, like if you end up getting your kidney under Medicare and you're under 65 years old, they stop paying for your medications after 3 years. And that's been this huge challenge that we've been trying to fix for years. I think overall, we do a good job using Medicare, Medicaid, what we can to get people transplanted, but it remains a real challenge in our healthcare system.
Do you ever look at your hands? I've been watching your hands. Do you ever look at your hands and say, I can't believe these do this thing? I mean, it is pretty. No, I'm serious. It is pretty amazing.
Take kidneys through belly buttons. I couldn't believe that you could actually, with these little teeny tiny sutures. And you know what else? I don't mean to be gruesome, but this was an incredible story that I didn't even know happened. Taking skin from people who have died for burn victims.
Right.
Tell us about how you do that.
Yeah, I mean, one of my earliest exposures to transplant when I was in medical school, I worked for the skin bank. And I was a second-year med student. I didn't really know much about this. But we would drive. I was in New York City, and we would drive around the tri-state area and actually remove skin from donors after the organ teams had been there. And it was sort of a bizarre, surreal experience, but for me, I learned how to do things in the operating room, but I also started to learn about this gift that can come from deceased people. And skin played an interesting role in the history of transplant, but the job was kind of weird and gruesome in many ways.
Well, you talked about a single piece of skin, correct me if I'm wrong, from the back to the feet.
Yeah, so we actually would... Well, if people aren't eating right now, we actually would...
Yeah, that's right.
I know. We would kind of infuse saline to blow up their skin to make them very, very tight. And then we have this almost lawnmower device where you would take strips of skin and you can actually take them all the way from the neck down to the foot.
You know, the book is When Death Becomes Life, Notes from a Transplant Surgeon. The surgeon is Joshua Mesrick. He's with us. So you end your... Well, you don't end it, but toward the end, you have a bunch of stories about different patients. Mm-hmm. Give us your favorite.
We have a minute.
I'm sorry.
I think the two. One, I mentioned Michaela briefly because I think the chapter is about how we're all the same on the inside, given this African American, you know, different background in Michaela. The other story, of course, I love is the story of Nate, who was a medical student, now is actually a surgery resident, who had a primary liver disease and kind of went through hell and back. But I feel like I learned more from Nate than he's learned from me about hope and fighting through and being stubborn and. He's an incredible kid.
And how old was he when he got this disease?
He found out about the disease when he was still in college, so like 20 years old or so, and now he's around 27. He just got his third liver transplant, but he's doing okay, so
Okay, how long do they, we got to go, but how long do they generally last if you have a liver or kidney transplant?
I mean, they can 15, 20 years. Yeah.
Okay. Congratulations. Good this is a great you. This is a great book.
Congratulations on the book.
Joshua Mesrick is an associate professor of surgery at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health Surgery. The book is When Death Becomes Life, Notes from a Transplant Surgeon. It is fascinating. You can catch him tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much for coming in, and thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you to people here at the Boston Public Library. You can catch us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow, the aforementioned Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, will be with us. Jared Bowen and Michael Norton from Harvard Business School. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Arjun Singh. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our on-site engineers, Gary Mott and David Cleckley. Special thanks to the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe. What's on TV, Jim?
I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that we are talking about the hearings, the bar hearings, and whether or not the attorney general nominee has passed the test. Will he be the next attorney general? Where is he on Mueller? And Susan Crawford, who teaches at Harvard Law School, has written a book that I started reading last night that is fascinating, and you'll love this too. It's called Fiber, and it's about another high-tech area where the United States of America is falling way behind the rest of the world. But she's actually got some solutions that are real world. So she's a professor at Harvard Law School. She'll join me, and we'll talk bar as well.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow, and have a great afternoon.